ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your host, Craig
and Matt
Allen.
And welcome back with Fight Night Picks, getting set for UFC 280. And thanks so much for joining us. As always, one half of your host duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, respective socials, Matt Allen FNP. And for Matt Allen FNP, a 9-2 showing
good
for
stuff,
Grasso right? versus Araujo. Matt, I would have gone 10-1 if I didn't switch the pick on question mark kicks of friggin' Pierre Rodriguez to Sam Hughes. But regardless, question mark kicks went off without a hitch. So many people joined in live 2 hours before the prelims. But as you know, for this pay-per-view card, you got the previews and predictions here right now. You've joined in for that. You check that box. You stick around. You toss a like. You do all the fan engagement. You've done your part. But Saturday... almost said Friday. Saturday, 2 hours before the prelims, question mark kicks, the sidekick during the main card. It is a big time showing. And if you halfway enjoyed last week's card that was Araujo Grasso on Fight Matrix, they had that as a 2 out of 5 card. This is a 4.5 out of 5 card. Like, the stars have aligned. Two title fights up at the top. Charles Oliveira taking on Islam Makhachev for the lightweight strap. There's no champion. Wink in that division. You've got Aljamain Sterling taking on the former two-time bantamweight champ TJ Dillashaw, and in the fight before that on the main card, the former bantamweight champ Petr Yan taking on Sugar Sean O'Malley. Matt, this card is stacked top to bottom with stars and ranked contenders. I think this should be an amazing card.
Every single fight on the main card of this weekend's pay-per-view is either a title fight or a title eliminator fight, and I think that's pretty darn cool. Like, every single time we talk about the main event of different fight night shows, that main event is either a title eliminator, or it's kind of like that half set before a title eliminator. The winner of the main event will then be thrust into one of those big fights. The fact that we have 5 fights of that caliber this weekend is absolutely insane, and this is one of the more stacked pay-per-views of the year. You do not need us to tell you that, but hopefully we can get you just that little extra 5-10% more excited for this card, because I really do think this is going to deliver. We have had two, let's just call them what they are, less than spectacular cards to get us to this point, but this is the card that really has been, they've been siphoning all the good fights in the last ones these past couple of weeks, but really going to make up for it this weekend.
And Matt is referencing the fact that in November UFC 281, you do have Michael Chandler taking on Dustin Poirier, but some fresh blood in the fight on the main card, Benil Dariush, Mateusz Gamrot. You also have Caitlin Chookagian, the former CFFC flyweight and bantamweight champ, taking on the former EFC flyweight champ Manon Fiorot.
That's a good one.
Matt, this is a stack card. We're going to throw it on over to our fight of the night screen. Make sure you comment below with your fight of the night. You're not wrong till Saturday night. We throw it on over to the fight of the night screen.
Let us know down below in the comment section who you've got. It's time for the fight of the night with Fight Night Picks.
And the first pick in the fight of the night screen, maybe a boomy like Roger Goodell, we have Petr Yan taking on Sugar Sean O'Malley. When you consider these two guys, both of them with 2 fight of the nights apiece in their UFC tenures, you look at it for Petr Yan, his last time out, split decision loss in the title fight against Aljamain Sterling earlier on this year. For Sean O'Malley, a no contest due to an eye poke against Pedro Munhoz, but these two guys definitely deliver when they're inside of the UFC's octagon. I think this is a great fight.
There's sink or swim fights, there's crossroad fights, and then there's, hey, do you want to fight Petr Yan on the other side of the world fights? And I gotta be honest, I don't think there's a lot of guys in the division who would sign up for an opportunity like this. I know fighting someone like Petr Yan on a pay-per-view main card, that's a really big opportunity for a lot of the fighters in this division, but for Sean O'Malley, one of the few guys who seems to just promote himself outside of the sport or independent from MMA, I'm kind of surprised that O'Malley is taking such a big step up in competition, because like you said, we didn't really learn a lot from the Pedro Munhoz fight. We learned a little bit, don't get me wrong, and I'm sure we'll talk about that later, but for the most part, O'Malley is making a massive step up in competition, taking on the former champion, and you know Petr Yan's gonna have a chip on his shoulder to try to erase the memories of his last performance in there, so I think we're gonna get, if not the best version of both guys, as close to the best version of both guys as possible. I think this fight's gonna be incredible.
If you look us up at Fight Night Picks on Instagram, we might have like 3,000 followers. It's not a lot. Petr Yan has 1.5 million Instagram followers. Sugar Sean O'Malley, add another million to that. 2.5 million Instagram followers. Matt, listen, let's get the club up, Matt. The Instagram fans aren't going to be a fan of this fight, but holy smokes, You look at Zubair Tuckagov taking on Lucas Almeida, and Matt gives me a weird look. This isn't his fight of the night.
No.
Let me pop my chest. This is my fight of the night. You look at Zubair Tuckagov, you might think short, compact, the guy brings
split
it.
Split decisions?
He has some split decisions on his record. He knocks guys down when you don't expect it. For Lucas Almeida, under the UFC banner, okay, you look at just jungle fights. He was dusting guys at 155 pounds, guys he was expected to beat. You look at him on Dana White's Contender Series last year, Daniel Zellhuber. It was as close to a fight of the night as you could get because they don't hand out bonuses. Almeida wasn't able to get it done there. But then he comes into the UFC, gets dropped by Mike Trezano in the first round of their fight, drops Trezano in the second round, drops him in the third round. It was a fight of the night. Performance, 50K in his bank account. That was his first, well, I guess it was his second fight outside of Brazil in his entire life. This will be his third. This guy puts on insane performances outside of Brazil under the UFC banner. And I think he has a willing dance partner in Zubair Tuckagov. Matt, this is a fight of the night to me, damn it.
I gotta be honest, there's five other fights I'd put ahead of this. I think Benil Dariush, Mateusz Gamrot's more exciting.
Yeah, Matt, cherry pick the big
fights. I think Volkan Oezdemir versus Nikita Krylov buried on the prelims is more exciting. I just, don't get me wrong, this isn't terrible. It's just, I didn't know what these were going into it. Piotr Jan versus Sean O'Malley, I can just go along. This one, I think it'll be a good fight, don't get me wrong, but I definitely think there's more obvious picks, let's say, for the fight of the night screen.
Folks, get off the board and let us know what your picks are for fight of the night. Maybe I set this one up in a certain way. I want to hear from you down below in the comment section. Let us know who you have in a possible fight of the night. We'll definitely try to respond to your comments and make sure you get down and dirty in the comment section. All right, so if you have a look at UFC 280, it's absolutely stacked at the top. But if you go down through the entire card, you talk about ranked fighters that you're going to find 16 total, including your two champs. And Matt, you alluded to it earlier. You go all the way down to the bottom. The first fight on the card, you might not be excited about it, but get excited about it. Carol Hossa taking on Lena Landsberg. They're both ranked in the women's bantamweight division. It and the featherweight division are probably the two of the weaker divisions in the women's rankings, but if you do look at it, both of those women are ranked. Krylov taking on Oezdemir, both ranked. You also have Sean Brady, Bilal Muhammad, and then every single fighter on the main card is ranked. Matt, this should be an incredible card, and a lot of sleepers on this card, and I didn't necessarily look at the odds, but I can see some fighters like the money team's own Mahmoud Muradov being slept on coming into this week.
Well, yeah, he had a tough go his last time out there, but that is going to be a really interesting fight at 185 pounds between him and Baraglio, and we just sort of glossed over it, but I do feel like this is a fight that could be a fight night worthy main event. Sean Brady versus Bilal Muhammad is a genuinely important fight. People sort of forget that Bilal Muhammad just beat the brakes off Vicente Luque, and let's be honest, that fight wasn't all that competitive. Like, his wrestling really did win out, but Muhammad's now training with Khabib and that sort of whole gym. They've been together. Khabib's going to be in his corner for this fight, and against a guy like Sean Brady, who, like, when the fight gets to the mat, he's as good as anybody in this division, and maybe even the UFC with his ground and pound and with his submissions. I just think that's one of those fights where stylistically you might look at two primary grapplers, be a little bit down on the fight, but I think those guys are going to have a phenomenal scramble fest type fight.
It should be an amazing fight, an amazing night of fights. Thanks so much for the support last week with your likes, with your comments. Keep it up this week, Matt. We have 14 total fights to break down, and if anything changes throughout the week, we'll have you covered here at Fight Night Picks. Matt, as we always say, let's get into it. Women's bantamweight. It's a division that rarely ever puts on fights, some of them good. And in this matchup coming up this weekend, we have Carol Hossa, a ranked fighter, looking to fight another ranked fighter for two fights in a row that's over 40 years old, and Lena Landsberg. And for Carol Hossa, Matt, we've been high on Carol Hossa for a very long time, and that hype is just gone. It's dissipated. It was like when steam engines went to electric trains. It's bye-bye.
It became obsolete.
You look at Carol Hossa in her last fight. She was taking on Sarah McMahon, and of course, the conversation is around the former Olympic silver medalist in freestyle wrestling, McMahon, and what can she do? She had spent some time away. Is she going to be able to look like her former self? Because for Sarah McMahon, she did, after all, fight for a title. Didn't go well against Ronda Rousey.
The Athens Olympics were a while ago, guys. Like, I remember the Beijing Olympics growing up. I was 10 years old when they happened. I have no recollection of the Athens Olympics whatsoever, and I was born in 1998.
Yeah, nor should you. You would have been six. But
that's
when
my
you
whole
do
point, though.
Consider this fight between Hossa and Landsberg. For Hossa, her last time out, it was uninspiring, was the performance. She got taken down over and over again. When she had her opportunities on the feet, it wasn't terrible. But for her in that fight against Sarah McMahon, I mean, it was bad. 4 of 6 takedowns for McMahon in that one. 10 minutes and 27 seconds of control time. And I got to say this. For Carol Hossa, if you look at her time inside of the UFC's octagon, she takes on Laura Procopio. She defends all of the takedowns. She takes on Vanessa Mello, defends the takedowns. So it was 5 from Procopio. Now, Fritzen, if you look for her out there on the internet. It was 2 for Mello. It was 1 of 3 was what Edwards was able to muster in that fight. And she was only able to get 2 seconds of control time. So Hossa popped back up. And then in the fight against Rowdy Betch Kohea in the retirement see you later fight, Carol Hossa defended 2 takedowns. I say all of this to say the takedown defense for Hossa in the UFC has been very good. And then she fought Sarah McMahon and it was very bad. And for Lena Landsberg, she likes to mix it up. Is she takedown heavy? Not necessarily. She likes to get into the clinch, throw a lot of elbows. She is, of course, the elbow queen. But for Hossa, we saw a giant portion of her game exposed, and it was a portion that on the regional scene we had seen exposed as well. It just hadn't reared its ugly head in the UFC.
And it makes me really curious to see if someone like Lena Landsberg, who, like you had mentioned, she'll use the takedown, but it's not really at the forefront of her game. She really is one of those fighters who, if you're a very technical striker, that's when she's going to look for the clinch, look for her own takedown. And if you're a really strong grappler, well, she'll kind of use this the opposite. Think of like a prime Ally Quinta. I know we have to go quite a ways back for that, but when you think about Ally Quinta, what's he really good at? Boxing and wrestling. If you're a top tier striker, he's going to use wrestling to take you down. And if you're a great grappler, think about the Kevin Lee fights, he's going to use his wrestling primarily to keep the fight standing. And Landsberg does have some similarities to his game, but she
his
really
game.
Does well, to Ally Quinta's game, okay. To his game. But for Lena, she does get a lot of her own offense done in the clinch. And I would say she has a lot less skills in the open cage with her own striking. And that's going to be a really interesting range story for both these women, because I do think Lena Landsberg can strike with Carol Hossa for a little bit in this fight. Don't get me wrong. It's not like Lena Landsberg is a complete zero on the feet and she can't get her own work done. I do think Landsberg is going to have to at least attempt a lot of takedowns in this fight, though, just to make Carol Hossa think. Because after her last performance, you know Hossa's probably assuming, okay, I just got taken down a lot. If my opponent did watch that fight, and you would hope that they did, or at least their coach did, they're probably going to go in with a very similar game plan. And if Hossa can defend some of those takedowns, I still think she is more technical on the feet than Lena Landsberg.
Which is a little bit of a hot take. Just a little bit, based on the fact that for Lena Landsberg, she is a former, what is it, IAMF Muay Thai champion, 2008 and 2012, IFMA.
And you're right.
And she had fought both the Shevchenkos in just pure Muay Thai.
But the thing about Landsberg is, a lot of the strikes that she does like, or the exchanges that she likes, she's also getting hit in some of those, and it's some of those give one to also receive one, or sorry, give one to take one type of exchanges, whereas Hossa, I feel like she's a little bit cleaner with her technique on the outside. I think she can hit a few shots, get out of the range and then reset. The only problem is, if Lena Landsberg has the type of game plan where she's kind of like zombieing forward, and we have seen this
just
in
like
the past.
Just like the last fight.
Exactly. It can look really good, but the thing about Landsberg too is, and I doubt it's going to change that if she's 40 years old, the output would be a lot nicer if it was about 15 to 20% higher. The strikes look good when they're on the feet, but she can get outworked by a superior striker. She can also get out grappled by a superior grappler, so I think this fight's going to be really interesting for just what range it takes place at, because I really do think both athletes to have their own little niches where they can have a lot of success.
And if you do look at it, just to go back and nitpick a little bit with Carol Hossa, pre-UFC, a lot of very, very good experience. She had fights against Larissa Pacheco. She fought Melissa Gatto, where she did get submitted, and that was kind of the thing. Got a little checked on the skill set on the mat. She is, of course, a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt, is Carol Hossa, but also fought Mariana Moraes and Gisele Mojea twice before making it into the UFC. But if you do focus on just Carol Hossa and the insane numbers that she puts out in terms of output in her fight, 6.65 strikes per minute landed to 4.45 received, that is a pretty tidy strike differential. And if you want the numbers, she had a knockdown and 171 significant strikes against Laura Fritzen. She had 120 strikes and 2 takedowns against Vanessa Mello. 125 to 62 were the strikes against Betch Kohea, and 30-27, 30-27, 30-26 before she she ends up losing to Sarah McMahon. But I love the output of Carol Hosa. She tends to keep her head in a decent spot, chin kind of checked in, at least close to her chest when she flows behind her jab. Throws very good output, whereas for Lena Landsberg, as accredited as she is in Muay Thai, and all of the fights she had against Pani Khanzad, one in 2012 in MMA, one again earlier
rivals
this year against Khanzad, the best part of her last fight against Khanzad, after a long layoff, she had a kid, you know, the combination of her and Akira Korisani, it goes from not just the gym, but they have a kid together out of Redline TC. You see Korisani, you also see Nicholas Dalby out of that gym as well. But for Landsberg, second round against Khanzad, they're in one of those zombie-like give one to take one exchanges. And then instead of throwing a punch, Landsberg lands a nasty elbow and it drops Khanzad. And those are where she's at her best. I don't know if she'll have those exchanges with Carol Hosa, but it remains to be said that the skill set of Landsberg has translated somewhat well from where she debuted against Chris fucking Cyborg to fighting Pani Khanzad for the 15th time earlier this year.
And I know this is difficult to say because she's 2-3 in her last five and she is 40 years old, but her skill set does age well. She's not someone who lost her athleticism and then immediately she doesn't have anything to show in her game. It is a lot of that pushing forward. It's more dedication than just pure athleticism, which is how Lena Landsberg wins her fight. So I think she's going to be able to make this fight very interesting, but I really do think the hand speed of Carol Hosa is going to be enough of an X factor for her to be able to be into a lot of those ugly exchanges with Lena Landsberg, but I just think Carol Hosa is going to be able to win out on a lot of those exchanges.
If you have a look at the odds in the matchup, Matt, Carol Hosa open a minus 275. She's minus 257 right now for Landsberg, open plus 235, plus 202. We have a look at the Tapology votes. Surprise to us as they are to you. I'm going to say over-under. If Carol Hosa is almost between a minus 250, minus 300 favorite, I'll say over-under 75% Hosa.
I was going to say over 70, so I'll say under just slightly.
You're going to say under just slightly?
Wow.
You're way over.
I'm really surprised, honestly.
977 total votes, 92% Hosa, 88% by decision. For the 8% that have Landsberg, 73% by decision. For me, it's the fact that Hosa can mix it up a little bit more. She's not as reliant on just single power shots like Landsberg is, and I love the volume out of Hosa. The fight against McMahon, it zapped the takedown defense, which had kind of held up, and not just kind of, it had held up for Hosa in her UFC tenure. But for me, I like Hosa in this matchup over Landsberg. We'll see if Landsberg can make it scrappy like she did against Macy Chasson. That was a pretty impressive win.
I think this is going to be a very similar fight to that Chasson fight as well. I do see Lena Landsberg being able to make this very competitive, but I still feel like Carol Hosa is the more skilled athlete. Now, with all that being said, it's one thing to give up takedowns to Sarah McMahon, and I do think Lena Landsberg is going to go for takedowns throughout this fight, but I do think Carol Hosa's takedown defense is going to be enough to at least stifle Landsberg. Now, that is a question we're going to have to keep on asking about Carol Hosa for basically every other fight she's going to have against these top-ranked women. So hopefully for Rosa, this is a bit of a realignment period. She can go in there, look good against Landsberg, and then get her back on that road that we had all kind of expected her to be on. Because right now, there's the likes of Holly Holm, Irene Aldana, Ketlin Vieira. Like, there's a lot of good fighters in this division near the top of it. And a lot of those fighters do need a dance partner. So I could realistically see the winner of this getting a big name opponent their next time out.
Carol Hosa is who we're both going with in the matchup. I struggle with words sometimes. 92% of the fans on Tapology going with her to get the win. Let us know in the comments section who you have in the matchup. Big time title fights up at the top. Bantamweight and lightweight strap on the line. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Ooh, girl, shock me like an electric eel. This is like the Justice remix of Electric Feel by MGMT. We have electric grapplers, Muhammad Makhachev, taking on Malcolm Gordon, fellow Canadian is Malcolm Gordon, and he's also a former TKO flyweight champ. He got the win over Yoni Sherbatov a few years ago, former Ultimate Fighter contestant and Laval, Quebec, Canada gym owner, Yoni Sherbatov. If you want that background, to share that at Buffalo Wild Wings with your buddies when you're watching the prelims of UFC 280. But if you can't tell how excited I am about this fight, it's up there. It's like a 9.5 out of 10. I love the title fights. They're 10s, but I love this matchup as well because for Malcolm Gordon, he's been an underdog in multiple fights in the UFC. He was a plus 115 against Amir Albazi, a plus 290 against Sumit Erji. He got finished in both of those fights. Plus 245 against Francisco Figueroa, and a plus 230 against Dennis Bondar. And in those last two fights, he beat Figueroa by decision. He beat Dennis Bondar in a fight where Bondar looked like he had some octagon jitters. They get into the grappling. Bondar gets a takedown. They kind of wrestle. They scramble. And then Bondar is posted up. And I talk about it twice, I will, during all of these videos for these fights. Because Gadjiel Mergadjiev, Caio Bahalio, posted up on that left hand. Illegal knee by Caio Bahalio. Dennis Bondar posts up with his left hand. Malcolm Gordon puts a little bit of weight on, and Dennis's elbow crumples like bad paper mache.
It reminded me of that. I don't know why Sportsnet, we were growing up, decided to show this replay like 50 times, but I just remember Andrew Bogut going up for a layup, his arm getting stuck on the backboard, and then him falling like Peter Griffin on a swing set. And for some reason, they show that highlight every 4 minutes growing up.
But for Malcolm Gordon, he probably watches that with his bowl of cereal every morning, because this guy had a great win. He picks up that finish, and it is off to the races. Now for Gordon, he gets Makhachev, a guy who you talk about off to the races. He gets a quick win over Cody Durden in his UFC debut. His next time out, he gets Charles Johnson, and you might think, hey, Makhachev had so much success in the wrestling against Charles Johnson that Johnson was just a fish out of water. Reel that fish in a little bit, because Charles Johnson, I talked about it, he was like a steeplechase champion. He was a wrestling champion. He won a Tiger Muay Thai scholarship. Charles Johnson was a former LFA champ at flyweight as well. Johnson's a good fighter. You're going to see him compete in the UFC, but it really is a nice feather in the cap of Makhachev to have a win that caliber. I know he didn't get the finish. I know, just like GSP before he fought Matt Hughes, like, I was not impressed with my performance or his performance, but I thought that Makhachev looked really good in that matchup, and it showed me even more that the guy has a nice, not just skill set, but a gas tank to go along with the skill set, that it isn't just, you know, live or die by the sword in the first round for Makhachev.
And his striking has impressed me at the UFC level throughout his tenure, because I really assumed in watching the tape leading up to his debut, it was a lot of explosiveness, but was there really that technique behind it when he wasn't landing those big shots? But I'll be honest, I really do feel like Makhachev has taken that step up since he has gotten to the big show. Now, I know that's an easy thing to say, and of course Malcolm Gordon, he's a well-rounded mixed martial artist. He's going to test that one area of your game that you don't have confidence in, and hopefully he can at least make this fight go long enough to where we learn a lot more about Muhammad Makhachev. Because Makhachev at this point, like, I know people who barely watch MMA who have asked me about him, and I gotta be honest, like, I don't know a lot of people who are just like kind of casual MMA fans. They're either 2 feet in or 2 feet out, but I have had people ask me about this Muhammad Makhachev guy, because he fought on that UFC London card, and I gotta be honest, that UFC London card for Frederick and New Brunswick people, I have no idea why they watch these cards, but I got stopped at a grocery store like 2 weeks ago asking about Paddy Pimblett, okay? People in our side of the country love those London cards, so I would really try to promote a lot more of your prospects on them, but this is what I keep on falling back to, because we've talked a lot about Malcolm Gordon on this channel, and honestly, we've talked a decent amount about Muhammad Makhachev. What's the one area of Gordon's game where he can actually challenge Makhachev in and make the fight very close? Because I do think his pure wrestling can make it a little bit interesting in some of the exchanges. I just don't know how sustainable that's going to be. I can see him having some success and then ending up on the bottom. And I just don't know what the one area of his game is where he can have a lot of success.
I have one. There's one area that Malcolm Gordon's better at Muhammad Makhachev at, and it's his boxing. When Malcolm Gordon decides that he wants to go out there and not go balls to the wall, which is when he has the most success, and also it's when he loses fights. Malcolm Gordon's got like this kill switch that he just lets off at the first part of most of his fights, and he usually ends up losing. But if you reel it back in, you look at Malcolm Gordon when he's having success in the Canadian regional scene, when he's fighting Francisco Figueiredo, when he's fighting against Dennis Bondar before they get into the grappling exchanges. Gordon, when he's purely boxing, he's got really long irons for this division. You can see it from the graphic. He's got a 1-inch reach advantage over Makhachev. I think that's going to cancel itself out, because Makhachev is a big time kicker and he has a lot of success from distance. So when I'm just saying that I think that Malcolm Gordon has a boxing advantage, it's probably not going to play out that way, but just hear me out, because he throws really good 1-2s. He throws from a very, very long range, and if you look at it, he can double and triple up on his jab, and he has a lot of success with his boxing. So Gordon, very good with his boxing, very good with his wrestling against 95% of UFC flyweights, which there are 18 unranked flyweights right now signed to the division. So it's not like it's just like women's featherweight and there's nobody competing. There are actually a lot of flyweights right now, contrary to like 2018. But for Makhachev, he's putting on a 31-fight undefeated streak. He was 23-0 as an amateur, multiple-time IMMAF world champ against very good competition. As a pro, undefeated except for that 1-0 contest, but you just kind of put that to the wayside and you continue on. But for Makhachev, coming out of KHK MMA, the Kingdom of Bahrain. For Malcolm Gordon, coming out of Adrenaline MMA, and I saw it over on his Instagram, he's got Chris Horodesky in his corner. You're going to see him there. Obviously, Mark Hominick's trained out of that gym, and Bazooka Joe Valtellini, but Horodesky, definitely a guy to get ready for the striking. 100%. A guy that was really flashy with his kicks back in the WEC days. A guy who retired super young after fighting Cowboy Cerrone. Like, I wish we got more out of Horodesky, but when you do focus in on this matchup, Matt, we know how good that the Wigan product in Muhammad Makhachev is, the Wigan Manchester adjacent guy. This is one of those matchups where it feels like all of the strengths are turned up a little bit more for the younger fighter.
It really does, because I do think Malcolm Gordon can at least make it competitive in a lot of areas in this fight. I don't think, the fight gets to the mat, he just gets washed because he doesn't have the grappling defense. Like, I do respect his grappling enough so that in some of these exchanges, I think he can be competitive. But it's like if you play enough 2K. There's a stat in 2K at the end, if you go all the way to the end, not your three-point shot, not your driving dunk. It's called intangibles. Malcolm Gordon's intangibles would be at like 50, let's say. Muhammad Makhachev's intangibles are probably at like 90, because he really does have that type of wrestling, the explosiveness, and the youth on his side too. Like, 32 isn't that old, let's be honest. Muhammad Makhachev's a decade younger than Malcolm Gordon is. Like, he's that young. He's going to get that much better each and every time we see him. Think about Tatsuro Taeha, the guy we saw last weekend. They could fight each other, which is kind of wild, and I think that would be an insane prospect-v-prospect fight, but hopefully the UFC lets that matchup marinate for a little bit longer. Let it be like a Shavkat versus Khamzat Chimaev, where hopefully they just meet each other at the top and not outside the rankings. But I do have Makhachev in this matchup. It's really difficult to pick against a guy who's almost a, 7-1 favorite in this matchup.
Yeah, I mean, Makhachev is just more than a 7-1 favorite. Malcolm Gordon on the comeback, plus 500 or thereabouts. Topology votes, I'm not even going to try and guess.
I'm going to say they're over 97%.
Yeah, they're probably, they're under.
One under.
1,096 total votes, 96% Makhachev, 67% by submission for the 4% that have Gordon, 35% by knockout, 40% by decision. But for me, I think Makhachev wins this one. I wouldn't be as confident as everybody else is in picking him to win by submission against Gordon, because I think Gordon has decent enough submission defense. His takedown defense is all right. His offensive wrestling is very good. His boxing is good. But I think Makhachev, with the kicks, with the advances in his boxing, and I really think the way that Makhachev cuts angles versus Gordon, Gordon very much is push forward, hunt for the neck, try and get the takedown. Makhachev is going to try and cut angles and attack you from odd spots. I think Makhachev's got the edge there, and I do like the cardio that I've seen in his recent fight.
That's the thing. It feels like every time you have one of these, like, top-tier prospects, the two questions is, can they eat a punch? Because we never see them take a good shot. They're so good. And how does their cardio hold up? For Makhachev, I don't know how he's going to eat a power shot against a guy like Piotr Jan or against a guy like Deiveson Figueiredo if he does make it to the top of the flyweight division. But at least we have one of those two questions answered. I think that's a great point. We know how good his cardio is going to last with his explosive and very physically demanding style. So I like Makhachev in this matchup, but hopefully Gordon can just last long enough to make us think more about Makhachev.
Watch the fight that Abdul Hussein had against Muhammad Makhachev. I'm going to talk about it in every single Makhachev fight, but there's a blueprint right there, and people go, oh, the guy's no good. Finland's got no good prospects. Go watch some Abdul Hussein fights, Matt. Both of us going with Muhammad Makhachev, the Punisher. Is he Thomas Jane? I don't know, but he's got a good opportunity at getting a win coming up this weekend. Let us know who you have in this matchup and the rest of the matchups on this 14 fight card. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Name Picks. We always say, let's get into it. The return of the Mac, the return of the Mark Coleman protege, AJ Dobson, looking to make a second time out with the UFC and taking on Superman Armin Petrosian. And Matt, when we look at this matchup coming up this weekend, AJ Dobson is really known for his boxing. Okay. Really slick combinations. You saw that in the first round of that UFC debut, his last time out. And he was taking on a guy who you could have bought at like a penny stock stage about a year ago, and now he's worth about $20 a share, and in a year it could be $100. I'm talking about Mamba Jacob Malkoon. Wow, what a win over Nick Maximov last weekend. But for Dobson, he looked great in the first round. He could defend some of the long range takedowns. He was really able to win out with a lot of his striking. And then in the second round and the third round, it was like Dobson was walking around in quicksand. He just couldn't figure it out. He didn't watch enough cartoons in the 90s. And Dobson really did struggle in that respect. And he lost that O on his record. So what did you make, Matt, of Dobson's last performance? And I guess some of the performances that he had leading up into the UFC.
He does look really good on the feet, but that's the thing about both these guys. They both look really good on the feet, and that's why I do think this has the potential to be like a fight of the night that is buried on the prelims, because for AJ Dobson, he is going to come out, work the jab, get into the pocket, and try to have a lot of his own success in that pocket. And I guess someone like Aaron Petrosian is going to be really interesting, because Petrosian, we all know how good of a kickboxer he is, we all know what his background is. He's not the most aggressive guy, though, for what his background is. It's really interesting to see, because think about a guy like Alex Pereira, a guy who has, now, yes, granted, he's one of the greatest kickboxers of all time, but still, you think about a big, strong kickboxer like him. He marches guys down, walks forward, goes to the leg, then to the body, then to the head. It's really that three-distance approach, if you will, and a three-level approach, whereas for Petrosian, he can kind of wait for the fight to come to him, and that's always been the strange thing to see, because he does have really effective footwork, and normally when a striker has really good footwork, they can lead their opponents into their power shots. Think about a guy like Robert Whittaker, and I know the examples I'm using right now are people at the top of the division, but still, Petrosian is a pure kickboxer, and that is his background. I love the movement that he is able to display on the feet, but it feels like it's unneeded at a certain point, and that's always been my thing with Petrosian. I really do think that if he does let his hands go at some point throughout his career, yes, that might make him more susceptible to the takedown, but also, it's going to help him accentuate the best part of his game already, and against a guy like AJ Dobson, you would think Petrosian's going to come in with a much more aggressive mindset, because, now, is Dobson the more well-rounded of these two athletes? I would say he is, but I still don't think Dobson has the mindset of, okay, I'm going to put on my wrestling shoes now. I think Dobson's going to go into this fight and try to at least strike his way into that clinch before he goes for his takedown attempts, because if he does just start shooting from a long distance, I do like the movement out of Petrosian. I know he said it might be overutilized, but he's a hard guy to get close to, and again, it might make it so that his fights aren't as exciting as you probably initially assumed that they will be, but it does make him hard to get a hold of, and against a guy who might try to grapple him, that's always a good skill to have.
Armin Petrosian has one sketchy detail to his record, and if you look at the 5-on-in, he is, of course, 3-2. You go back, he was the AMC Fight Night's lightweight or light heavyweight champ. Be crazy if he was a lightweight champ, but light heavyweight champ, and he loses to Hassan Youssefi. That's a good fighter. You've seen him fight a lot of good talent on the regional scene. Loses that fight by knockout, and then a couple of months later, he goes out there and has another fight, and that's kind of the craziest part about his overall record. Is it 7-2 or is it 6-2? You go over to SureDog today, it could be 7-2. You go over to Tapology, they consider it 6-2. And the win that he had on his record that's in question, and I found a great article. You know Jay Petrie from SureDog for his good work with Fight Finder, the Ashgar Mazharov stuff. Well, he had an article that came out earlier on in October about Mr. Petrosian and his fight that he had against one Zemyakov, and in that fight, it is sketchy business. He couldn't find the fight. The promoter didn't really seem to have it. The management team didn't really want to talk about it all that much. And then somebody finally slipped out an unlisted video. It was on YouTube. That. And if you go back and watch it, it's weird. So
just Draymond Green punching Jordan Poole, and they're saying it's Armin Petrosian.
Well, it wasn't as cool as like a GSP or Draymond Green Superman punch. But for Petrosian, he's taking on Zemyakov, and he goes across and lands a left body kick, drops his opponent, and then follows it up with ground and pound. The opponent stands up, smiling, and that's the end of the fight. It was really weird.
But none of the skills he demonstrated in that fight are actually back upable, if you will, by other fights that he's had. Like, there was nothing in that performance that makes me think, okay, he can't land switch body kicks. Like, that's something we know he's been able to do his whole life.
And the best part about it is he obviously gets the win on Dana White's Contender Series. He's a decent favorite in that one against Kaolan Kovalev, and he wins that one by knockout. And then his next time out, he beats Gregory Rodriguez
by split decision. An oddly bad fight, though.
Yeah, it's not a great fight, and I thought Gregory Rodriguez won the fight, but regardless, it's a win on Petrosian's record. He goes in against Kyle Bahalio, and in that fight, Petrosian, after beating Gregory Rodriguez, who had looked very good in the UFC before the Petrosian fight and has looked very good since that fight, Petrosian's a plus 200 underdog against Bahalio. And I thought, what, really? Like, I know we'd pick Bahalio to win that fight, but you go back and you look at it, he defends 1 of 5 takedowns, so Bahalio gets 4. 10 minutes and 9 seconds of control time. The judges scored at 2, 30-27, 129-28. he looked pretty darn bad, and he couldn't defend a double leg all the way across the cage. Like, his takedown defense hasn't gotten much better since he's come into the UFC. It wasn't his strong suit outside of the UFC. We know how good Petrosian striking is, but I look at a guy like AJ Dobson in a matchup like this, trains out of Immortal Martial Arts. He's had Matt Brown and Mark Coleman in his corner before. His win over Wesley Golden on the regional scene, you're able to get the fight down to the mat. A no-hook rear naked choke. Like, I know he doesn't have his legs around him. He's just on the side cranking for a rear naked choke. He also got that submission on Dana White's Contender Series to book his ticket into the UFC. It's not something that works against the highest level competition, but it has for Dobson. To go along with his boxing combinations, all this to say, Matt, I'm not high on either one of these prospects who are over the age of 30 at this point.
I'm really glad that you had said that, because that was going to be my final remark on this fight. This should be a fun fight, I think. I genuinely do believe that. Now, I don't know what either guy's ceiling is, because it really is difficult to project based on what their current skill set is, but I think this will be a fun striking fight. Now, I kind of tip my hand. I do ever so slightly favor Petrosian, just because I do think his movement is going to make him very difficult to take down. Now, I don't know if that's going to help him offensively a lot in this fight, and honestly, it might make for a bit of a stale striking matchup between two guys who you wouldn't assume would give you a fight of that caliber, but I still do like the movement of Petrosian. I know I think he moves a little bit too much, but in a matchup like this, I actually think that might be a benefit to him.
And when you do look at Petrosian, even in the fight that he had, against Gregory Rodriguez, it was a success in the striking to the takedown of Rodriguez. You look at the odds in this one, Petrosian open minus 210, minus 225. You look at it for Dobson, open plus 180, still about there, plus 190 or so. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprised that as they are to you. And with a guy like Petrosian that big of a favorite with that Rodriguez win, I'm going to say over under 70% Superman.
I think it'll be over.
Superman that. Whoa, it is over. So 1,040 total votes, 86% Petrosian, 59% by knockout for the 14% that have Dobson, 52% by knockout. Matt, I kind of like the odds on AJ Dobson just based on the fact that I like his striking and tight. I like the hooks of Petrosian when he is backing out, so I think that he's going to have a lot of success there as well with his kicks. But I think Dobson is the more well-rounded guy. Didn't love the fight that he had against Malkoon, especially he could have called one of the rounds a 10-8. He gets taken down fairly easily in that one. Petrosian's cut from the same cloth, so if they decide to strike, I think Petrosian's a little more well-rounded. But again, I don't see these guys having a giant high of a ceiling, and if you do like the underdog in this matchup, I'm not going to fault you whatsoever.
I've also got Petrosian, but again, it's going to be really interesting to see what the odds are based on his future opponents, because it is really going to be matchup dependent to see how big of a favorite he is, because we know what his skill set is. He can defend takedowns with his footwork, he's a very skilled striker, but guys who we can't really use those two skill sets to exploit, they're going to have success against him, so I do like Petrosian in this fight, but again, it's really going to come down to what is his next matchup after this fight.
Is it 6-2? Is it 7-2? We're still going with Superman. I'm not that naive. Armin Petrosian to get the win. 5 for fighting the tune. Matt, we have some big time matchups coming up this weekend, including the two title fights up at the top that you're not going to want to miss. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Omar Gadjiev picked up his first loss since his amateur days in his UFC debut, and he's looking to move down to welterweight for the first time since his amateur days in 2014 in taking on one Abubakar Nurmagomedov. And Matt, if we put our full names into a Scrabble score, I'll go first, Craig Allen. I get 13 points. We'll say that you're Matthew Allen for this one.
Oh, I feel like you get a lot more.
20 points for Abubakar Nurmagomedov. He gets 37 points. For Omar Gadjiev, 50 Scrabble points. Matt, what do you make of that?
I would not want to play against either one of these gentlemen
if they use their own names. But Matt, when we do look at the matchup coming up this weekend and we focus more on Omar Gadjiev, who's training out of MMA Factory, bet you didn't know that one, with Fernan Lopez, who's going to be all the talk of the town coming up this weekend. It was kind of weird. We both picked him to beat Caio Bojalio in his UFC debut based on the fact that the Combat Sambo Master of Sport was going to have success, and you guessed it, Combat Sambo. And for Omar Gadjiev, if you watch him fight outside of the UFC, you watch his fight on Contender Series, his fights that he had on the regional scene, once he got guys down, they rarely got back up unless the round ended. His takedowns were so good. His top pressure was very good. His boxing was meh. But he's boxing to clinch to then get the takedown. And for Omar Gadjiev, he looked great in all those fights. Against Bojalio, He couldn't get back up off the mat
at all.
So weird.
And I was really surprised to see that. Now, we do see a lot of grapplers at the UFC level be really good offensively, for instance, with the wrestling. But defensively, they will still struggle against the other high-level wrestlers. Normally, though, once the fight hits the mat, other than, like, Sarah McMahon, who just really struggles off her back, but is also really good in the top position, most people who are really good in the top position can also have success grappling off their back. Now, to be fair, Caballero is a really good grappler, a really good fighter in his own right.
And he's on this card.
Exactly. And we're going to talk a lot more about him in the future, but I definitely thought Omar Gajiev was going to have more success in those areas where kind of the Venn diagram would have them both, if you will. And I really think this fight against Abubakar Nurmagomedov is going to be an interesting one for Omar Gajiev, because if he can get him down and actually control Nurmagomedov, that's going to be a real nice surprise for everybody involved, because I don't know how surprised we both were with Abubakar after his last performance against Jared Gooden. He went out there and looked like a brand new man. He had nice striking. He had distance management. He was moving well on his feet. Now, when you think about Abubakar Nurmagomedov, there seems to be two different types of Nurmagomedovs, if you will, in the UFC. You have the karate-based ones who have really good striking, and you have the Khabibs who just go out there, take you down, and beat you up with ground and pound. Abubakar, at one point, was more cut from the Khabib cloth. He was much more grappling-oriented, but he has made those advancements with his striking, and I think that's going to be really interesting to see if he can continue to build on the success he had his last time out there against a guy like Omar Gajiev.
Because if you focus on it for Abubakar Nurmagomedov, international master of sport in combat sambo, and the craziest part when I did the deep dive for this fight, and I'm watching the tape, and I'm looking at the odds for all these fights, I'm going to give you real numbers for Abubakar Nurmagomedov with World Series, with PFL, and then in the UFC as far as what was he like when he was matched up and given odds. So World Series debut against Moreno, minus 800. Matthew Frenku, minus 450. He's taken on Hawad, minus 385. Pavel Kusha, that he lost to, but he fought against him while in combat sambo, they went against each other. Minus 1420 was Nurmagomedov, and he lost that fight. Against Weston, minus 740. Against David Zavada in his UFC debut, minus 315. Gets the takedown, gets submitted by triangle. And then against Gooden, minus 220. So Nurmagomedov is typically a giant favorite in the majority of his fights. And if you go back, regional scene, World Series, PFL, UFC, Nurmagomedov is a takedown machine. Even in his fight against Magomed Mustafayev, he's working the takedown in the Sochi Cup. He gets the takedown two or three times. He gets it twice. He goes for the third one. Spinning back fist, cuts him. The referee sees it. End of the fight. TKO loss due to the cut. But for Nurmagomedov, great takedowns, great top pressure, great control. And then all of a sudden, his last fight against Jared Gooden, it was okay. Gooden's a good striker. Nurmagomedov is good at the takedowns. Nurmagomedov's going to take down Gooden. Gooden walked around the cage with his hands down by his waist. And Nurmagomedov doubled up, tripled up on the jab, switched stances, and threw powerful hooks from both hands. He would throw knees up through and uppercuts. Nurmagomedov looked like a leveled up guy. And not like, okay, this is a 23-year-old that's found a new wrinkle to his game. This guy's over 30. I love what I saw out of Nurmagomedov his last time out. I hated what I saw out of Omar Gajiev, but we have to remind ourselves as MMA media, MMA talkers, and MMA fans, you can't just go with just the last performance.
And Nurmagomedov was fighting a guy who was very worried about the takedown, and that's why his hands were down by his side. I don't think Omar Gajiev is going to be as concerned about the takedown attempts from Nurmagomedov, and that should allow him to be at least a little bit more comfortable on the feet. Now, Omar Gajiev is not a great striker by any means, but if he doesn't feel uncomfortable by the takedown attempts of Abubakar and Nurmagomedov, I don't think there's levels in between their striking games, unless Abubakar's still been able to make gains over the last time he was in there, but that's the problem I keep on going back to. Let's say Nurmagomedov had another performance in between his last win and this one, and he'd been able to showcase more of that striking against just another opponent. Nothing against Jared Gooden, but just being able to showcase that a second time in the cage, that would give me a lot more confidence to be okay. He's going to go in there for a third time fighting that very similar manner. I still think he has those skills, don't get me wrong. I should be a lot more confident in picking him if I was able to see them demonstrate it at least one more time before this weekend.
Again, it's tough to let the pendulum swing too much, and if you consider it for Nurmagomedov, he's usually a pretty big favorite. He was due to face Daniel Rodriguez, old D-Rod, last summer. He was out of that matchup earlier on this summer. He was supposed to take on Phil Rowe. He was also out of that matchup. And for Omar Gajiev, his last fight, maybe you should have won it due to DQ, because it was an illegal knee by Kyle Bahalio as Gaethje was trying to post up and stand back up.
I still always go back. Michael Bisping poked Alan Belcher in the eye when they fought, and it was a technical decision afterwards. Should he have been disqualified? Well, maybe it is an illegal technique, but there is precedent for this, and it's happened a lot in UFC.
It was the same night as Martin Budai and Chris Barnett, where he had the illegal strike to the back of the head that ended up as a technical decision. So when we look at the odds in the matchup, Omar Gaethje came in as the underdog, still about there at a plus 150. You have Nurmagomedov minus 175, the favorite. We have a look at the topology votes, Matt. Surprise to us there, to you. But again, as I talk about pendulum swinging, I know what MMA's like. I'm going to say over under 72.5% Nurmagomedov.
I think it'll be under.
It's going to be under? Oh my goodness. Well, good job. 1,014 total votes, 54% Nurmagomedov, 85% by decision for the 46% that have Omar Gaethje, 70% by decision. And again, for Omar Gaethje, you go through it, the nice submission win by knee bar against Jancy Silva, the Muay Thai artist on Dana White's Contender Series, got him into the UFC. And even in the fight against Kyle Bahalio, when he was down, he kept trying to go for leg locks, whether he was trying to go for the submission or scramble to get back up to his feet. That was Omar Gaethje's plan. Matt, you look at this matchup. I've got Abubakar Nurmagomedov here. I think he's better in the striking, because Omar Gaethje isn't bad. He has a nice long jab. He's got some pop at the end of his shots. But I do see Nurmagomedov as having the better striking. When it comes to the fight on the mat, I think Nurmagomedov's got a little bit more of a step on Omar Gaethje. But again, the red flag here is don't let the pendulum swing too much, and tune into Question Mark Kicks on Saturday, because Omar Gaethje hasn't fought at welterweight since 2014 when he was an amateur, but he wasn't winning those fights at welterweight. He was winning them up at middleweight. So I want to see what Omar Gaethje looks like given the weight cut here.
I also love Abubakar Nurmagomedov, mainly for his footwork on the feet to go along with his striking. Not only do I think he has the striking advantage, but he does seem to move quite a bit more effectively in that striking range. He's not someone who just has awkward movements on the feet. He can make really good defensive movements moving backwards and forwards. I think that's going to be real key in this matchup. So I agree with you. I've also got Nurmagomedov.
Both of us going with Abubakar Nurmagomedov to get the win. Let us know whose Scrabble score completes your win down below in the comments section. We get some big time fights on this card, including the Bantamweight title on the line between Aljamain Sterling and one TJ Dillashaw in the main event. Holy smoke, Charles Oliveira, Islam Makhachev, you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
And a big time UFC debut for the 19-year-old Yamato Nishikawa, who debuted as a pro at 13 years old and debuted as an amateur fighter at 11. Matt, how fucked is that?
It's pretty fucked up, I'm not gonna lie. I was playing baseball and basketball, you know, being a normal kid in that time, not fighting other, well, hopefully children and not grown men in a locked cage, but wouldn't you market it like that? Yeah, it just sounds like he's fighting adults from the age of 13, or 11 to 13. That's pretty fucked up, yes.
Well, for Yamato Nishikawa, if you go back and you look at his record, he was fighting younger guys back then, and he has been a product out of his father's gym, Nishikawa Dojo, and his father's name is one, I want to make sure I get it right, Takahito, and he's been his coach the entire time. But if you do like JMMA and you have been excited about some of these prospects that you've seen last weekend, Tatsuro Taira, he's very young, he's about 22 years old. You also can't forget about Matt One, Yusaku Kinoshita, who was on Dana White's Contender Series this past year and picked up a giant win in a main event and got a contract. But if I do go down and I look at it for Yamato Nishikawa, the level of competition, oh my goodness gracious. I added the wins and the losses of everybody that he's fought, because for Nishikawa, he is, after all, 21-3-6. The level of competition, 172, 118, and 48. That boils down to a rounded out average of 6-4-2 for the average opponent that he's taken on. And he just fought back in September. About a week after his fight in September, it was announced that he would be replacing Jamie Mullerkey in this matchup against Magomed Mustafayev. And I went through the entire record. I translated a bunch of articles that I found on the web that were in Japanese over to English to get ready for this one. I did the deep dive, folks, for you folks. He's fought at bantamweight all the way up to welterweight. He also had a fight at openweight. He has a lot of fights that have been two-round fights. And if you go, well, guys, why does he have so many draws on his record? funny that you should ask, because there's a lot of fights in Japan that are two-round fights, and if it goes over the allotted 2 5-minute rounds, then they just consider it a draw. So that's why he has 6 draws on his record. But going down through it, I'll throw up the Yahoo Sports quotable that I did translate. Doesn't seem like the moment is too big for him. Seems like it's another fight. He wants to become UFC champ, taking it one step at a time.
All of that's fair to say until you fight Magomed Mustafayev in your UFC debut before you turn 20.
The craziest part about it is, though, Mustafayev's been out for a while. It seems like a skill check for Mustafayev, but man, they're not doing him any favors.
But it's weird that it feels like a skill check for the older guy, because normally when you have these young, talented prospects, you try to build them up over time, you know, make them fight like, and this isn't a good example because this fighter's looked very good lately, but a Jim Miller type character, you know what I mean? Just a guy who's been around the division for a very long time. They are a faded star. They're not the fighter they used to be, but they can still go out there and put on entertaining performances. And if you beat an opponent like that, then it gets you off to a great start in your UFC career. This is going to sound really rude, but everyone's going to agree with me on this. Magomed Mustafayev has 5 fans. Like, I don't think there's a lot of people who are saying, hey, babe, Magomed Mustafayev's fighting on Saturday. We can't do anything. Like, nobody has ever said those words ever. So it is very strange that they're making this very young, talented prospect not only fight a guy who's older and very skilled in the division, but they're not giving him a guy who has a big fan base, who's already been there and done that. Like, Magomed Mustafayev is one of those fighters who fights a good fighter once every year and a half. And he'll look good against that fighter every year and a half. He might beat them, he might lose to them, but Mustafayev is not an active fighter himself, and he's never really had those big opportunities to make you think, okay, if you beat Mustafayev, then you're in line for really great things to happen.
Brad Riddell, it worked out for
him. But Brad Riddell was already on the rise before that. Brad Riddell was this kickboxer who had the Israel Adesanya connection. Nobody knows who Brad Riddell is just because he beat Magomed Mustafayev.
It definitely got him up there, but my question,
Matt, it's a good win.
Magomed Mustafayev has a giant, giant win on his record, and it's that spinning back fist knockout out over one Rafael Fiziev in the UFC. You look at it, he has a loss to Kevin Lee, and that's all right. But you look at his other 2 big-time wins, and I mean, Matt, you consider these ones, I mean, holy smokes. He beats Joe Proctor by finish. He beats Piotr Hallman by finish. He loses to Kevin Lee by submission in their matchup. He also has a win over Abubakar Nurmagomedov by finish, who's on this card. It was a cut caused by spinning back fist. It was a spinning back kick, you're right, against Fiziev. But Matt, my big question against Nishikawa, because the conversation has to focus there, is, well, can he play baseball?
His name is Mookie Betts. I said, Poppy, can he play baseball? He said, man, can he play baseball?
I think he can.
You think he can play baseball? Well, we look at Nishikawa, and I went back and I looked at his fights. Shinya Aoki fucking hates him. Shinya Aoki is not a fan.
Shinya hates everybody. If you've ever seen his interview, he just flips people off and yells at
them. Shinya Aoki was doing commentary.
He's also 40 years old.
Nishikawa wins the fight. Aoki comes in, and then he's like landing elbows up to him against the cage. Nishikawa's like, what are you doing here? But if you do look at it for Nishikawa, this guy is well-rounded. And of course, when you're training under your dad, you start at 11 as an amateur. You start at 13 MMA. What's his base? His base is MMA. It's not like it's combat sambo. It's not like it's Muay Thai. His base is MMA. He is very well-rounded. He's fought an all right level of competition. I know he's got wins over guys that are like 16-5. But again, when you boil everything down, 6-4-2 is the average record of the guys he's fighting. His last 3 fights that have been, of course, wins, he's won 14 in a row. But his last 3 in 2022 have all been at welterweight. And his last one was over a guy, Kusa Max, who was 41 years old. And in that matchup, they just kind of go at it. I mean, Kusa Max is a former Heat lightweight champ, but if you go and watch the fight, like, they're just kind of like trading for trading's sake. And when I went through and I watched a lot of Nishikawa fights, it's a lot of give one to take one, rock 'em sock 'em type of striking, where the younger guy's winning out. He's defending takedowns, he's getting his own takedowns. He is a good striker and he can switch it up. He throws a nice lead uppercut. He can, you know, go to the body, which I do like in combination, going to the body, back up to the head, fainting quite a bit. He is a well-rounded fighter. It's just, to me, coming up this weekend, it feels like way too much too soon.
I think he's Josh Brolin, who just found $40,000 in a briefcase in No Country for Old Men. I think Magomed Mustafayev is going to win this fight easily. I really do. It's just, this is the weirdest matchmaking going, and I can't stress this enough. Normally, I get on this channel to tell you guys that, hey, MMA's a lot more like boxing than we want to realize. They do want to build their stars in a very similar way to what we criticize boxers for doing, where you don't fight anybody for like 20 fights, and then you get the really big test. And MMA, it's not the same. You're not fighting people with negative records, but there definitely is a slow build that they like to do with a lot of their prospects. Now, to be fair, Sean O'Malley is finally jumping into that pool by fighting Petr Yan, but you do get it. For the most part, prospects don't have difficult fights until they're about 5-6 fights into the organization. Then we can start to test them. It's really weird that we are taking this guy who's not even 20 years old and making him fight the much more proven commodity. Like, and again, for Mustafayev, it's not like beating Mustafayev then gets you all these fans. Like, it's a good win that people like Craig and I are really going to respect, but the broad-based MMA fandom isn't going to completely change their opinion about you just because you beat a guy like Mustafayev. And mainly that is because he hasn't been active enough. And that's always been the strange thing. He's been a very talented fighter for a lot of his career, but when you're not in front of our eyes, it's very easy for us to forget about you when there's other MMA fighters in your division having 3, 4, 5 fights a year. And for Mustafayev, that has always been his issue. I think he's a skilled fighter who just hasn't been in the forefront of MMA fans' eyes, and that's why I do think he's getting this weird opportunity. Like, I don't know why the UFC wants Mustafayev to win this fight, but it feels like
because he was supposed to fight Jamie Mullerkey originally. Mullerkey falls out, but if you do look at it from Mustafayev, even in the fight against Brad Riddell, he gets dropped by a looping right hook, and then Riddell ends up holding him. And then Mustafayev gets, what, 8 takedowns in that fight?
He got lit up on the feet, though.
That's the other part of it. Mustafayev's very good at standing. He's got a pancration freestyle wrestling base. But if you look at Mustafayev, as good as he is of a striker, he's very, very adept at his offensive wrestling. And you look at the matchups that Mustafayev was supposed to have after the Riddell loss, which he could have arguably won in round 2 and round 3. He's booked with Renato Moicano a couple of times. Moicano falls out. You've got Mustafayev falling out. He's supposed to fight Demir Ismagulov back in 2021. He makes it to the scale. He weighs in successfully. Demir for 155 weighed 163.5, so the fight fell out, and then Mustafayev just goes away again. But so
to be fair, though, a lot of those fights against those guys were kind of before they became a big deal in the division.
Are you fucking kidding me?
No, like, Gamrot before that fight hadn't really had a lot of his marquee wins. I know he had the KSW success, but just in front of the UFC fans, he hadn't. For Renato, I think that was him coming off of the RDA loss. It's just a lot of those fighters hadn't become the big deal that they are today. That's why he went from fighting those guys to supposed to fighting Jamie Mullerkey this year. I would say all three of those guys are a step and a half above Jamie Mullerkey.
The trouble in this fight, folks, is, and as much as we agree and disagree about it, the odds, I mean, you've got Mustafayev open a minus 800 favorite, minus 561 right now. You look at it for Mr. Yamato Nishikawa, he opened up as a giant underdog, plus 550. He's a plus 394 as it stands. We look at the Tapology votes, Matt. We won't even piddle around.
We already saw them.
Yeah, I mean, 912 total votes, 79% Mustafayev, 67% by knockout. For the 21% that I'm Nishikawa, 51% by decision, 19% by knockout. I think that Mustafayev can put the wrestling shoes on in this fight and end up getting the win over Nishikawa. And I think when it comes to the striking, Nishikawa, if he blitzes, can have some success, because I do think his striking is half decent. I just think it's too much too soon in a debut on short notice.
In the UFC, they wear 4-ounce gloves, so anything's possible. We have seen Mustafayev get hurt and rocked in the past, but that was against very high-level strikers, and I just think this is a step too far too soon for Nishikawa. Like, I think he could have a very promising UFC career. The problem is, they're throwing him into the deepest part of the pool possible right away. It's not like, oh, we'll give you a life jacket, we'll see how you do. Like, this is a really difficult matchup for him, so hopefully Nishikawa can show us enough to make us really excited for future opponents, but I think this is a really tough debut.
We'll see how much Mustafayev's fallen off since the 2020 loss that he had to Brad Riddell, but both of us going with the sniper to get the win coming up this week. We have a big time slate of fights in the main event, title fight in this division. Holy smokes, you have a big time card coming up that you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Featherweights battle it out in the Abu Dhabi heat as we have Artem Lobov's former foe, Warrior Zubair Takugov, taking on Brazil's former Jungle Fights lightweight champ, Lucas Almeida. And Matt, I'm going to get this off my chest right now before we go too far into this video. I didn't think Lucas Almeida was very good coming into the UFC, and I have a different approach right now. He had a fight of the night style fight on Dana White's Contender Series, lit up Daniel Zellhuber which looks, I guess, not great in hindsight.
He looked great, though.
Zellhober didn't look great in his fight against Trey Ogden in the UFC, but Almeida looked amazing in the first round, decent in the second round, but Zellhober took over in rounds two and rounds three to get the win. But after the fight, Dana White said that if Almeida was able to go out there, get another win on the regional scene, he would be right back into the glimpse of the big-time promotion. And for Almeida, all he had to do was go back down to jungle fights, retain his lightweight title with the promotion, and then he ended up fighting Mike Trezano. And again, for Almeida, not really the greatest level of competition down in the Brazilian scene, and not really the greatest guy that he fought his last time out. It was a blown-up featherweight at lightweight. But if you do look at it for Almeida in that UFC debut against Mike Trezano, I mean, hey, that's a former Ultimate Fighter winner we're talking
and
about.
And a difficult guy to look good against, too. That's the thing about Mike Trezano. I know the average MMA fan might not be as high on him as they once were, because, like you had said, he does have an Ultimate Fighter championship to his name, I guess. But Almeida was able to go out there and look phenomenal against, like I said, a guy who's really hard to look phenomenal against. Think about when Luis Pena was the hotness in MMA at one point. Now, I know that was a while ago, but still, Pena did not look good against Trezano at all, and that was a prospect who, at the time, people had that, like, Sean O'Malley-type expectations for him, and the fact that Trezano was able to go out there and just one of those veteran performances, like we mentioned with a lot of these fighters. If you're a good striker, they can wrestle. If you're a good wrestler, they can strike. That's normally what Trezano was able to do against a lot of these fighters, but Lucas Almeida just looks so good on the feet in that matchup that there really wasn't much for Trezano to do.
And Almeida didn't look too hot in the first round. You're, I mean, right, it was a left hook to a knee that dropped Almeida, and he was on Beach Street, as they say. And then for Almeida, round two, round three, it was his left hook, and it's like a pullback, long, looping left hook for Lucas Almeida. Drops him in the second round, then in the third round, drops Trezano and just hammers away and gets the win in that matchup. So for Almeida, a huge win. It definitely boosted my thoughts of Almeida just in general. And I mean, if you do look at it, he switches camp up just a little bit coming into this one, and I think it's going to pay dividends. But for Takugov, the same can be said, because he's a guy that's fought out of a few different gyms, aka being the primary matchup. But if you do look at it for him, and I'll throw up a picture that he had on his Instagram, he's hanging out with Roger Huerta. He's over at Tiger Muay Thai. And there's been a lot of fighters out of Tiger Muay Thai lately. Piotr Jan in your main card pairing with Sean O'Malley, that's training for his fight at that gym. But a lot of big-time fighters that have come through there even just recently. So for Takugov, gets to have that in his back pocket. But I think the craziest thing for Zubair Takugov into this matchup is he doesn't fight very often. Like, in the UFC, he fought twice in 2014, once in 2015, once in 2016, twice in 2020, and once in 2021. And in all of those fights but one, Takugov is actually the favorite. The fight that he was the underdog in was the fight against Kevin Aguilar, where he lit him on fire.
I really like the skill set of Zubair Takugov, but there's one thing that he does that I can't stand, and it's like the Fabricio Verdum mindset of, I need to get this one back. Takugov is a very technical striker on the feet, and he's a very good wrestler, of course. If you've ever watched his fights, he is just extremely well-rounded. Like, he can get it done on the feet. He's an extremely good grappler. But when he gets clipped on the feet, he gets a little of that, like, Hulk Hogan in him, where he's like, oh, I've got to get that back. And when he does have the squared stance, the thing about Takugov is he doesn't have very long arms. It's always something that stood out to me in his fighting style. He has good boxing. He has good kickboxing, I would say, but he's not huge on kicks. He is going to try to much more get it into the boxing range, where he can attempt his takedowns as well. But that's the one area of his game that I'm always worried even lesser fighters can take advantage of. Because even if you're a guy that Takugov might be a far better wrestler in, he might even be more technical than you on the feet, if you hit him with that one good shot on a weird in-between where he's going for a takedown, I do sometimes worry that he's just going to get in his mind of, okay, even though I'm going for the takedown, I've got to get that one punch back. Because Takugov will have some of those moments where, again, he's a massive favorite in a lot of his fights, but some situations will be real dicey for a second, and then Takugov will be able to get over it. I'm just worried that as he starts to fight some of the better fighters in this division, are those times of adversity going to get a little bit bigger and a little bit bigger and a little bit bigger as he keeps on developing in the division?
Because, I mean, if you consider it for Takugov, he has fought a very good level competition in the UFC. He obviously does have that draw on his record, the split draw against Lerone Murphy, a guy who I really think highly of. Split decision loss to Hakeem Dawodu. But if you consider it, the UFC debut was against one Douglas Silva, Deion Drage, and he wins that fight. Beat Ricardo Ramos his last time out, which is, again, another one of those wins that, it really does hold a lot of water. He was a big favorite in that one, which was a surprise to me at the start, but after watching that fight, it definitely was merited. And for Takigov, the background, he is a master of sport in combat sambo and hand-to-hand combat. And for Almeida, background in kickboxing, Muay Thai, and a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt. So the pairing's very good. You said, like, for Takigov, got to bring it all together to fight the upper echelon of competition. This might be the opportunity where Lucas Almeida just shuts the lights out and we don't get another opportunity, because for Almeida, 14-1, all of those wins by finish, and the one loss that he has is by decision, and out of all the finishes, 9 of them are in the first round. If you don't get out of first gear, Almeida can finish you, and if Takigov tries to will himself out of first gear, that could really be a good opportunity for Almeida.
My real question is, though, what does this do for Zubair Takigov if he's able to win? Because it does feel like a lot of his fights are sort of storyline related, if you will, to try to get him near the top of the... Not to
like,
get him
like
near the top
of the
division.
Like when he jumped into the cage
exactly. Like,
Conor
there was
going to
be the Artem Lobov fight that didn't actually happen. There's just... With Takigov, it feels like he has had not the biggest promotional push in the world, but the promotion is definitely behind him. And a win against Lucas Almeida, it's a good win for your career, don't get me wrong. But like you've said, he's beaten some really good fighters in this division and fought some really good fighters in this division, so I just don't know how much more this helps raise his stock if he is able to get the win against a very dangerous opponent. But for Takigov, it would be nice if we did start to see him fight those borderline top 15 guys to finally figure out how good he is. He had a close fight with Moicano all those years ago. We know that Moicano at one point at featherweight was one of the better fighters in the division. At lightweight, it's been a little tricky, for being honest, but for Takigov, it would just be nice if he started fighting some of the more recognizable names in the division. Now, I know Dan Hooker moved back up to lightweight, but a guy like that, you know, somebody who's been in the top 15 for a while, it would be really nice to just see Takigov test himself, but also be more consistent in the cage, and I think this should be a great fight.
Takigov currently ranked the 17th best featherweight over on Tapology. That's regardless of promotion. For Lucas Almeida, he's actually ranked 48th, so a big time opportunity for Almeida. We talk about the odds in the matchup. Takigov opened the underdog, plus 130. He's now a minus 155 favorite. The line kind of corrected itself quickly on best fight odds for Almeida. Open minus 150. He is now a plus 129. So roles are reversed in terms of the odds. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. They're a surprise to us. They are to you. I'm going to say over under 70% Takigov.
I think they'll be over just because he's the much more well-known fighter.
And they are just slightly over 1,070 total votes, 72% Takigov, 84% by decision for the 28% that have Almeida, 39% by decision, something that's never happened before, and 48% by knockout. And I think if Almeida wins, it's not like we've never seen Takigov rattled, rocked, and hurt.
Exactly.
Almeida's got a damn good shot in this fight, and I'm a little hesitant in making my pick, which is Warrior, change it, Zubair Takigov. I like the well-roundedness. I don't like the takedown defense of Lucas Almeida, though he is a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt. I've seen him taken down in fights like his fight against Cuccio on the regional scene with jungle fights. Not to say that he didn't win, and Almeida did obviously get the finish in that matchup, but even long telegraph takedown attempts from across the cage he has struggled with. I think Almeida could end up being, he's the harder puncher out of these two guys. He might even be the better striker at the end of the day, utilizing his length. Like you said, Takigov's small arms and he's compact.
He just hulks up. That's the problem.
And he does have, he is at a reach disparity and height disadvantage. And Almeida is the bigger guy, but I like Takigov with the well-roundedness in the matchup, and I will have him here.
And I do think Almeida is going to start striking in a much more conservative manner if he does find himself getting taken down a lot. I don't think he's going to be as willing to let his hands go and to really go for the risk if he is on the receiving end of a lot of the takedown attempts from Takigov. So I agree with you. I've also got Zubair Takigov.
Both of us going with the Warrior Takigov to get the win. Let us know down below in the comments section. I mean, I'm close to it if you're going with Brazil's Lucas Almeida. Can Takigov go 3-1 against Brazilians inside of the UFC's octagon? That loss to Nato Moicano all those years ago. Big time fights on this card, including two title fights up at the top that you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Big time matchup coming up this weekend. It is a Fight Night Picks special. So tell your weird Uncle Chris to grab an Alpine. A, it's camo can season, so get ready for that stuff. And tell him that there's going to be violence on free television, because coming up this weekend we have No Time Volkan Oezdemir taking on the minor Nikita Krylov in a pivotal light heavyweight matchup, because for both of these guys, incredible skill sets that they possess. For Oezdemir, you remember the No Time on his way up, his slow burn into the UFC, the first fight, it was like, okay, this is Volkan Oezdemir. And then all of a sudden, he was knocking guys dead. He ends up fighting against Daniel Cormier at UFC 220. And y'all must have forgot. It just went so bad for him in that matchup. He was in a main event in a fight night against Anthony Smith in Fredericton. No, it was Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada. I said Fredericton. I have St. John in the mind with the Alpine, but it was in Moncton. And Oezdemir struggled in the matchup, and he got finished. And since then, it's been wishy-washy. But his last time out against one Paul Craig, Matt, boy, oh boy, did he defend all the takedowns and look very good.
He looked really good, and I'm going to zag a little bit. I don't think Volkan Oezdemir looked that bad against Anthony Smith. He had a lot of success in the striking. He had his own success in the grappling. Now, granted, he broke his nose and his cardio fell off a cliff, but I really do think that in the early parts of that fight, there's a lot of things that you can take from and actually apply them to this fight against Nikita Krylov, because for Volkan Oezdemir, it has been an interesting UFC run. He was one of those few prospects who really gets that heavy promotional push. It's, hey, you are no time. It's a division that doesn't have a lot of exciting contenders right now.
There's a poster in the corner of this office
that never
shows
to bring up.
15 seconds, the quickest finish for him, and 22 for Anthony Smith.
He had an awful fight against OSP in his UFC debut, though, that I feel like we have to bring up, where they just kept on calling him a Swiss kickboxer, which I thought was weird. Not really an area known for their kickboxers, but still, he is a really high-level striker. The run that he was able to go on immediately after that fight with his knockout wins over Misha Serkinov and Chewy Manoa were really important. Like, the Manoa fight was a very hyped-up matchup. Manoa was just coming off his KO win against Corey Anderson in his hometown. He was a very hyped up contender, and DC had actually signed to fight Jimmy Manoa at one point. A lot of people forget this, but Daniel Cormier himself has admitted this. It was Daniel Cormier signed two contracts for UFC 214. One was for John Jones, and the other one was for Jimmy Manoa. It's just John Jones, a much bigger fight, of course. They end up putting Jimmy Manoa against Volkan Oezdemir, and we kind of know where both guys are in their careers right now. If you've watched a lot of MMA, it's been a while since you've seen Jimmy Manoa, and Volkan Oezdemir can still be competitive against high-level opponents, but that's the weird thing about both these guys and both of their last matchups. I really don't think there's a lot to learn about either one of them. For Volkan Oezdemir against Paul Craig, it was one of those water and oil type fights where if the fight goes to the mat, Paul Craig's going to have a good chance to win. If the fight stays on the feet, of course Volkan Oezdemir is going to win too. And on the flip side for Nikita Krylov, he looked great against Volkan Oezdemir, that was a Mike Goldbergism if ever there was one. He looked great against Alexander Gustafsson his last time out, but the caveat I always put on that fight is it's been a while since Alexander Gustafsson's been called the mauler in a cage. He had fought at heavyweight, he had retired multiple times, so for Krylov, it was definitely a great way to get back on winning track. I just don't know how many skills we can take from that original fight and then apply them to this one as well.
I think Nikita Krylov, when it does come down to this one, you consider the background that he does have in MMA, and of course he is a Kyokushin karate black belt, and you know that. He started karate when he was a kid, he brought it into the octagon, at heavyweight when he weighed 218 pounds, taking on a guy in Walt Harris and knocking him out in 25 seconds. Now, he debuted against Soa Pallelli, but we'll forget about that fight. Krylov at that time was 21 years old and already making moves. He ended up having success at light heavyweight. He went away back to Fight Nights Global. He came into the UFC, and it's been a little wishy-washy. And if you look at the last five for Krylov, loses a split decision to Glover Teixeira. No shame in that one. Mauls Johnny Walker in their fight to kind of steal from the Gustafsson nickname. He was all over him in that one. Fights Magomed Ankalaev. Struggled with Ankalaev's takedowns on the feet. There were some 50-50s. Took on Paul Craig and was beating the brakes off him and pretty well had him knocked out until, you know, it was just an Undertaker rest in peace. Wake up from Paul Craig, and he ends up submitting him, lapse in judgment. And then he fights Alexander Gustafsson, and he just went off in that matchup. He had the kicks, he had the knees, he had the strikes from distance to end up finishing Gustafsson, dropped him twice in that matchup, and it was a short shot that ended up getting the finish. But for Oezdemir, I go back to the Paul Craig fight, and again, 15 of 15 was his takedown defense in the matchup against Craig. Some of them were a little lazy and labored.
And a lot of those are going to be like pulling guard where he just stands up.
You're looking at the matchup. A lot of people, you got to kind of cleanse your palate, because I know Oezdemir was a slight favorite in the matchup against Paul Craig. 72% of 4,300 Tapology voters had Craig to get the win in that pairing. And Oezdemir was able to get it done 30-27. All the shots on the feet. And I do think it does contribute a bit from that pairing into this one. The fact that he's been training at All-Stars in Sweden, getting ready for Craig, defending the takedowns, getting ready for Krylov. And yeah, if it's strike for strike's sake, Oezdemir can have a lot of success with his own boxing combinations. But when it comes down to the well-roundedness of Krylov, if Oezdemir can defend the takedowns, that just augments his striking
that much more.
And that's why I do favor Ozdemir in this matchup. I know that's weird to say I favor the underdog, but still, for Volkan Ozdemir, this fight more than any other, or I guess most of his fights in the UFC, comes down to, can he keep it standing or not? Because on the feet, I really don't think Nikita Krylov has the type of power that he was able to demonstrate his last time out. Now, yes, he dropped Gustafsson with basically every clean shot he was able to land on him. I don't think that's going to happen to Volkan Ozdemir, though, who hasn't declared his retirement 17 times leading up to this fight. I'm sorry, I was a big Gustafsson guy at one point, but just the shadow of him that we've seen in the UFC as of late has been really disappointing. I just favor Volkan Ozdemir on the feet, and that's really where I do primarily see this fight being contested at. Now, Nikita Krylov is tricky with his grappling, and I know we disagree on this, we're just going to. I don't think Nikita Krylov's a bad grappler. He's not. He's not the best grappler, though, because he is one of these grapplers who can really struggle on the defensive when he's fighting other guys who can really go out there and be physically strong with not only their submission game, but they're also or with the wrestling game as well. Think of, like, Glover Teixeira. And again, when I'm using championship caliber examples, it might not be the best example to go with, but Nikita Krylov on the feet, oddly enough, was able to be awkward enough to have some success. But when that fight did hit the mat, Nikita Krylov, who is a good grappler in his own right, was really struggling with some of the physicality of Glover when he was able to get in that top position. To be fair, again, I don't think Volkan is going to use his physicality in the same way. I don't think he's going to shoot for his own takedowns, but I think he is strong enough to at least defend a lot of those early takedowns. And on the feet, I don't discredit Nikita Krylov's striking, but I think he's a little bit too single shot oriented fighting a guy like Volkan Ozdemir, who can really get into combinations when he gets on the inside. And I know this example's from a little bit a while ago as Craig makes faces to my right, but when Volkan Ozdemir had fought Ali Latifi, he looked great in that matchup, and I've really been wanting to see that version of Ozdemir for a while, because if that's the version that we got time in and time out of the octagon, I really did think Ozdemir would kind of be back in the mindset that people thought of him when he did fight Anthony Smith in that main event. Ozdemir, I think, could be another Anthony Smith type where it's like, okay, we've got a main event that we need filled. A 205er would be fun. Who can we throw in that main event slot? Now, I know for the last 3 years, it seems like Anthony Smith has got each and every one of those opportunities, but I really do feel like, and I should say, just for the winner of this matchup, that should be in their destiny. They should get the opportunity to go out there, showcase their skill set in a 5-round fight, and then a lot of more people would be convinced if they got like a title eliminator next time out.
Nikita Krylov's last two fights come out hot on the feet and thrown a lot in combination, mixed in his kicks with his punches better than he has in a very, very meaningful amount of time, and he's looked very good. So that is where I disagree, but we have a look at the odds in this one. Krylov open a -188 favorite, -175 at this point. For Ozdemir, you alluded to it, open a +140, +145 or thereabouts. We have a look at the topology votes, Matt. Surprised us, they are to you, but again, like 72% of the fans and everybody in our comment section had Paul Craig to win against Ozdemir. I expect Ozdemir to not be a fan favorite here, but I expect it to be close. I'm going to say over under 60% Krylov.
I think it'll be under. Now, maybe that's just me because I favor the underdog in this matchup, but I thought they would be under.
67% I have Krylov, 62% by knockout, and there's only 8% that I have by submission. Okay. Just 33% of Ozdemir, 58% by decision, 35% by knockout. Matt, I think Nikita Krylov is more wonky when it comes in terms of his striking. I do like Ozdemir's takedown defense that he's shown in the majority of his UFC fights. The majority of the UFC fights, Ozdemir has good takedown defense. You go back and watch his fight with Bellator when he's fighting Kelly Knudsen, a championship wrestler. Knudsen takes him down, submits him. From that point to this point, yeah, it's 10 years ago. He's improved leaps and bounds with his wrestling. So credit where it's due with Ozdemir. He's a more technical striker in this, but I think Krylov, with the mix of takedowns, the wonky striking, the decent gas tank that you wouldn't think goes along with all of this, I think Krylov gets the win in this weekend for being more well-rounded.
I think the leg kicks of Ozdemir are really going to be an important part of this fight. It was something they showcased a lot in the early tenure of his UFC career, and I know we all became just enamored, if you will, with the knockout power that Ozdemir has, but it's like Jerry West said about Kevin Durant. People are going to fall in love with your scoring, Kevin, and they're not going to pay attention to the other things you do well. I really do think Volkan Ozdemir has other parts to his game that are pretty high level outside of just his punching power, and that's why I do like him in this matchup. I think his takedown defense is good enough to defend the takedowns from Krylov. If it does hit the mat from some weird kind of scramble or anything in the clinch, then yes, I definitely favor Krylov once this hits the mat, and that's all I was going to say. If you think Krylov's going to win by stoppage, I don't know if knockout would be the way to go. Submission, yeah. I would say, if it does end inside the distance. I would definitely favor that to be his method of stoppage. Whereas for Usmir, I think he can have success on the feet, especially with his boxing combinations. I expect him to use that leg kick a lot to try to slow down the movement of Krylov, but this should be a great fight. I am as excited for this fight between two guys who might be way past their prime, if we're being honest, than ever any other on the cards. Because at 205, there's not a lot of exciting contenders right now. You've got the Ankalaevs, you've got the Jan Blachowiczes, the Rakiczes, but they've all been around for quite a while right now. It'd be really nice to see Krylov or Usmir, whoever's able to get the win, be able to go on a run and fight some of those top contenders.
Let us know in the comments section who you have. We're splitting the pick, Matt, going with Polar Pop, Volkan Uzdemir. I've got Nikita Krylov to get the win. Big time card coming up with the two title fights. Up at the top, you're not going to want to miss it. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
You threw your waders on, you're knee-deep into the fights at this point. Give yourselves a hand, and thank you so much for joining in with Fight Night Picks. Your support keeps this channel going and growing. The likes, the subs, they are appreciated. But I say this because we need your help. We need to hear from you in the comments section. Coming up this weekend, we have a contentious bout between... Listen, it's Makhmud Muradov taking on the natural, not Robert Redford. It's Caio Bahalio. And in this matchup, it's an oil versus water pairing. You have the crisp boxing of Muradov, and I'll get into the numbers, but he does not throw kicks. He's taking on Caio Bahalio, who has a karate base and also fights out of the Fighting Nerds in Brazil. He is very much a wrestler grappler type. And for Bahalio, such an interesting case, already 2-0 in 2022. Matt, he could be the next Scotty Barnes of the UFC. He could be Rookie of the Year.
Let's calm down a little bit. Nobody's as good as Scotty B. But I was just going to say, we made a dumb hair bet last weekend where you said you'd dye your hair blue. I said I'd dye my hair blonde. Now, luckily, our hair is still the same.
Jordan Wright versus Disco Todorovic.
Would you get like a Cal Bahalio neck tattoo if we were wrong in a prediction? Is that a bet you'd be willing to? I wouldn't. It's just such an aggressive tattoo is what I always think. I'm really excited for this fight though, because again, these are two fighters who I feel like a lot of people have sort of lost their stock, if you will, of Makhmud Muradov based on his last performance against Gerald Meerschaert.
The guy's chopped liver.
Exactly, and that's what everybody assumed that these like eye-catching prospects are the second they lose a tough fight against a really talented fighter. But you guys watch our channel, so I know you know how good we think Gerald Meerschaert is. And that's the thing, losing to a guy like Gerald Meerschaert, where you land a lot of your own power shots, and that has to be said, it's not like Makhmud Muradov got hit by a punch and submitted Bruno Silva style by Gerald Meerschaert. Like, Makhmud Muradov had a lot of his own success in that matchup, but it was a case where he's throwing these power shots, he's landing these power shots, but Gerald Meerschaert just won't get knocked out. It doesn't matter what he lands on Meerschaert, he won't get knocked out. And that was the thing about Muradov. There's different kinds of losses that you can have in the UFC. There's losses where, let's just be honest, you give up. There's losses where you don't look as good as we thought you were going to look. And then there's losses where you just go up against a guy whose skill set is completely opposite from yours, and there's areas in the fight that you're going to struggle with that he's going to succeed at. And feel free to disagree with me if you want to, but that's kind of how I look at Muradov's last performance. You can't look at it and say, oh, he didn't show up utilizing the skills that I think he does, because he had really good boxing combinations. He landed his power shots, he landed his jab, he looked really good. The problem was, when the fight did get tough, and when the fight got to where Gerald Meerschaert excels in, that's when he struggled. But it's not like that's the first time he said that about a prospect. Think about Deron Wynn all the way back when he was the hotness. And I know it's easy to chuckle now at Deron Wynn, but still, Wynn was a prospect who had a lot of hype behind him until he fought Gerald Meerschaert. Now, he didn't have a ton of success after that point, but I still think a loss to Gerald Meerschaert is enough for people to completely get rid of your career and forget about it.
And the fact of the matter is, you just look at the loss on the record by finish, and it's going to look really bad, but you go back and you watch that fight, and for Muradov, he was unloading with his boxing combinations in the first round. He had Meerschaert rocked at multiple points. He had him drop. He even went into his guard and started hammering away with punches. He had a lot of success. He got a little bit tired, and then the fight took over, and Meerschaert was able to get the win. But for Muradov, since joining the UFC, it was a 3-0 start. From 2019 to 2021, he beats Alessio Di Chirico, Trevor Smith, and then Andrew Sanchez. Two of those three wins were performance of the night bonuses over Sanchez and Trevor Smith. And if you do consider it, for Muradov, 17 wins by knockout or TKO, to contrast, four losses by submission on his record. And a lot of those losses were very early on. He went on a very big win streak. He got signed to the money team because for some reason Floyd Mayweather was in Europe and met Muradov and decided, you know what, let's put pen to paper and become buddies. And for Muradov, maybe it would have been better to take exhibitions with Ryzen. Maybe it would have, but he's in the UFC at this point. Now, it should be noted, the three guys that he beat, as I just mentioned, Di Chirico, Trevor Smith, Andrew Sanchez, are they gracing the UFC's middleweight division next week? Or ever?
Can I say this, though? I actually thought the Andrew Sanchez win was a really nice one. Because Andrew Sanchez is the type of guy who can go in there and wrestle. And I know he's got that weird combination of karate and wrestling that we don't often see outside of, like, a George St. Pierre or a Henry Cejudo.
Or Kyle Bahalio.
But for the most part, we only see that skill set at the tip-top of the divisions. But for the fact that Muradov was able to look that good against a guy who, again, Andrew Sanchez isn't going to blow your socks off. He's not going to completely change your outlook on MMA. But I really do think that's a good win just based off what Muradov's skill set is going into that fight, because we all assumed he would struggle with the wrestling and, of course, have success with his own boxing, but he was just really able to use his physicality, and I think that's a really important part for Muradov. I don't think he has terrible takedown defense. I don't think he has great takedown defense. I think he's a really strong guy in the middleweight division, and I really do think that that strength is something that really helps and hinders him depending on who he's fighting.
Muradov is massive for this division. He's got a tall frame. You can see it there. He's going to have a 4-inch edge in height in the pairing, and he's also going to have a slight half-inch reach advantage, and he really does like to box on the outside. When I said at the start of the video that he doesn't throw a lot of kicks, just in the UFC, against Alessio Di Chirico, he threw 3 leg kicks. Well, he landed 3 of 4. He tried to throw none against Trevor Smith. He ended up knocking him out, getting a performance bonus. Against Sanchez, 11, and then against Mearshart, 5. He's not a big leg kicker. Now, for Bahalio, we touched on it. He does have a low-handed karate stance, one that a big boxer with power punches could land against. He has good takedowns. He throws really good kicks, does Bahalio, but he closes distance very well. He rushes across the cage. He powers into his takedowns, and if you look at it, in Dana White's Contender Series lore, he beat Aaron Jeffrey by taking him down and holding him down. That doesn't happen very often. Then, a couple of weeks later, 3 weeks later, he fights Jesse Murray up a weight class. What does he do? Well, he finishes him. Then he takes on Gadzhi Omar Gadzhiev. Technical decision, illegal knee at the end of it, but he ground out a combat sambo champ. And then his last time out against Armin Petrosian, he held him down for over 10 minutes of control time.
And I feel like a lot of people were down on Bahalio after that Omar Gadzhiev fight, but I gotta be, like, if you just break down what his skill set is, I don't care if he landed a potentially, well, it was definitely an illegal strike at the end of the fight, but you know what I mean? Like, if you, you could get down on a guy because you didn't like what he did at one moment in a fight. But if you're trying to predict how his fights are going to go in the future, you just have to look at his skill set. And when you just look at his skill set, it's like borderline Jaltan Almeida-esque when he gets guys on the ground. Now, I know Almeida is that top-tier prospect in the heavyweight,
catchweight,
cruiserweight, light heavyweight, catchweight division. You get the idea, though. Bahalio is cut from the exact same cloth. When he gets guys down to the mat, there's a certain, it's just the weight that he carries, and it is very uncharacteristic. You don't look at a guy like him and think, wow, he's as big as a middleweight can get, like Mahmoud Muradov is, but it's the way that his technique is utilized, it's the way that he can apply his weight when he gets in that top position that's really unique to his size.
And a really, really good lead right hook that he does have. That's how he dropped Jesse Murray on Contender Series, and also a left hand like a piston when he throws it.
And that's what I was going to ask you. I think you're going to agree with me, but Cal Bahalio has a lot more to offer on the feet against Muradov than Muradov has to offer on the mat against Bahalio if it does end up there.
Yeah, that much is true. And you do look at this one. We've seen Bahalio even cornering fighters on Contender Series out of the Fighting Nerds. Were they winners? Were they losers?
He seems like a smart guy.
We won't touch on, well, maybe that's the glasses. I don't know. But if you do look at it for Bahalio, he is the favorite in the matchup. Minus 200 at open, minus 225 right now. He's a minus 200 favorite his last time out against Armin Petrosian, who's also in this card. For Muradov, he doesn't have to see skeletons in the closet because Jiro Mearshart's not on
this
card.
Who was the QB who was like, I'm seeing ghosts when they fought, or when they played Bill Belichick? That was really popular. He played for the Jets.
Was it Mark Sanchez?
I don't know. I'm just thinking, like, for Muradov, this could have been a quick signature on the contract. You know, you're fighting a guy who's younger than your last opponent, who has a lot of the same skills as your last opponent.
For Muradov, since his last time out against Jiro Mearshart, he backed out of fights against Misha Serkinov and Abus Magomedov as well. So for Muradov, underdog, open plus 170, plus 180 right now. Matt, the fan vote over on Tapology. You folks, sometimes, we all do it. Let's just admit it. We all do it. We just consider a guy off one loss to be completely chopped liver, and I hate him. Just like people just don't like Giga Chikadze now because he lost one fight against Calvin Kattar. The Fight Night Picks fans can be crass that way. I'm going to say over-under, though, 75% Bahalio, because I think that's happening in this pairing.
I'll say over.
You're going to say over. It is over.
I'm a little surprised, though.
1,108 total votes, 85% Bahalio, 58% by decision, 27% by submission. For the 15% that I'm Muradov, you've got 44% by decision, 35% by knockout. I think Bahalio wins the pairing. I think it's going to be contentious because I haven't always picked Bahalio to win these fights. I picked him to beat Petrosian. I picked him to lose against Omar Gadzhiev, and he looked amazing in that fight. But I do think the power takedowns that he has and the little bit more that he can offer on the feet than a guy like Mearshart is what's going to win it for him in this matchup. But again, I could be wrong, and I could be buying low on a guy like Murata because his boxing is so good. 17 knockouts, and he has lightning in those combinations. Great angles on his punches, and he knows when to mix in his power with his volume.
I agree 100%, but that's the weird thing about Muradov. I agree with you. You can't completely get rid of him in the division because he lost to Gerald Mearshart. If he loses this fight, though, in a similar manner to how he lost against Gerald Mearshart, that's when we're going to have to start having a conversation about what your ceiling can be overall.
And if you look at it for Muradov, I'll throw the picture up here before we leave you. Michael Olszewczyk at Ankos MMA, and also in the corner, who's that? Oh, it's Yaroslav Amosov. And has he only been there for a couple of days? Nope, it's been weeks, specifically for this
game. And you guys know how much I love Lord Michael and his skill set, but that's my problem with Muradov. He's fighting a guy who, if you just think about, like, archetypes, if you will, of UFC fighters, Jared Mearshart and Kyle Bahali are basically the exact same. Like, they're both guys who can strike their way into the clinch, who can get the takedown from the clinch, and then really dominate you with their grappling. I think there's a chance for Muradov to win because he has such exceptional punching power. He's so big for the division. But we've just matched their skill sets up against each other. Think about UFC 1. What won at the end of UFC 1? Everybody was only good at one martial art. It wasn't really mixed martial arts. Well, the jiu-jitsu and the grappler guy beat the pure wrestler guy in Hoist Gracie. So for that reason alone, I'm going to take that lesson I learned 27 years ago before I was born. I like Kyle Bahalio in this match.
Well, let's going with the natural Kyle Bahalio to get the win. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have. No wrong answers until Saturday night when it's all on the line. It's a big-time card coming up this weekend with two title fights up at the top. So keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Bilal Muhammad keeps winning fights as an underdog, and all of a sudden, from winning a giant main event in the rematch against Vicente Luque's last time out, he gets the main event. The prelims coming up this weekend at UFC 280, taking on the undefeated phenom out of Henzo Gracie Philly. It's Sean Brady. And for Brady, inside of the UFC's octagon, he was a straight to the UFC after being a CFFC big-time welterweight champ. He beats Court McGee, drops him in that fight, beats Ismael Nardiev, the Austrian Superboy after Wonderboy, Superboy, whatever it was. He got
lit up.
Blitzed in the first round, did Sean Brady, by Nardiev, and then round two, round three, Brady took him to the deep waters. If you look at it against Christian Aguilera, performance bonus for the submission, he beats Jake Matthews by submission. His last time out, he beats Michael Chiesa. Looked great in round one, looked great in round two, looked dicey in round three, and almost got finished. There was 10 more seconds of that fight. Michael Chiesa was in top mount, hammering away, and he would have won by TKO, but the bell saved Brady in that one. You're never supposed to say that, but I just did. Brady looked really good with the takedowns, really just held backpack against Chiesa for large portions of that fight.
Which is wild to think about a guy who's as good at grappling as Chiesa.
And when it came to the striking in the third round, the coaches told Chiesa, it is on the line, you gotta finish this fight, you gotta get it done. And Chiesa, all throughout that third round, looked amazing on the feet, landed combinations. Brady got hurt and had to panic wrestle, and that saved him in spots, but nearly came to his detriment. For Bilal Muhammad, at the start of his career, throughout his career, the chin's been a little bit of an issue, but as it's progressed, his boxing has really come together. His body kick from southpaw is amazing, really is nice, Muhammad. Right? It's an underrated part of his game, but we know exactly how good his wrestling is. And for Muhammad, in his UFC tenure, I mean, holy smokes, he's what? 12-3 with a no contest? If you look at it, he has 91% takedown defense. Damian Maia got one. He also missed on 20 of them. Jordan Meehan got one and got 36 seconds of control time. So Bilal Muhammad almost untakedownable, if that's even a word, and his takedowns have been really good.
Can I say, it's fucking nice to see a guy make improvements throughout his UFC tenure, isn't it? Like, Bilal Muhammad is unrecognizable from the first fighter he was when he came to the UFC.
It's like if you got banana bread that turned into creme brulee.
Like, I don't know if you guys play video games, but you watch MMA, so you probably do. I know I do. You know when you, like, a movie, a video game, anything, there's a first act, a second act, and a third act. I actually think it's pretty easy to figure out where the acts of Bilal Muhammad's career are, and we can actually go through them right now on Tapology, because the Takashi Sato fight set up the third act that we're in right now, which is weird to say, but the second act was really set up by his Alan Jobain loss in his UFC debut.
Fight of the night.
I was just about to say, a lot of you guys might not remember that performance, but that was a great fight against Alan Jobain, where Bilal gets dropped early on in the fight, but really rallies late, and that's the great thing about Bilal Muhammad. I know with Sean Brady, there's a lot more question marks right now, and that really is what this fight is. Bilal Muhammad is the answer. He's the truth. He's like Paul Pierce. And Sean Brady's the one who we still have questions questions about, and we would like to get them answered, because
he's Devin Booker before Chris Paul.
Exactly. A trash player. Don't get me started. Hit me for my hot takes about the Phoenix Suns and Devin Booker, because Devin Booker fucking sucks. Sorry, I'm fired up now. But that's the thing about Bilal Muhammad. He had that run to his career between Alan Jobin and Takashi Sato where he was winning fights, he was losing fights, but he was getting clipped a lot, really, no matter who the opponent was. I remember thinking he lost to Tim Means. The Jordan Mean fight was close, but he did win. The Chance Rencanter fight was weird because it felt like, okay, Bilal Muhammad's so much better than this guy. Why are we doing it? But I will say, his striking at least started to show improvements in the Rencanter fight. Now, the loss to Jeff Neal was bad, but the Takashi Sato fight and the Lyman Good fight showed real progress in Bilal Muhammad's game, because the Takashi Sato fight showed us, okay, he can't just wrestle, or he doesn't just need the wrestling. He also has finishing ability on the mat, too, with his jiu-jitsu. He was all over Sato in that performance, got his back, choked him out in the third round, when Sato basically had nothing left to give just because Bilal has such good cardio. And against Lyman Good and Diego Lima, because these two next performances are very important, he looked great striking against both of them. He lit up Lyman Good on the feet, and Lyman Good's a weird fighter because we know how he struggles with the takedown, but how powerful he is.
I remember there were extenuating circumstances. Lyman Good's father just passed away before that matchup. There was COVID before the matchup. It was a weird one coming into it. I had question marks after he beat Lyman Good. I thought he looked good. And then he fought Diego Lima and came out like a boxer and boxed his ears in.
And that was a nice thing to see, because we know, okay, if Diego Lima's going to beat Bilal Muhammad, I believe Bilal was a very big favorite going into that fight anyways, but if Diego's going to beat him, it's going to be by fluke knockout. You know, puncher's chance. He does have good power, and Bilal's been caught before, but Muhammad was really able to use his distance management, and that was really nice to see from a guy who normally just crashes for it and really has to use his pressure to then open up the other parts of his game. And then, of course, the third act of his career, you can include the Leon Edwards loss, but let's just be honest. Like, Leon Edwards,
that was a no contest.
It was a no contest. He got his ass beat in that fight, though, for being honest. He got head kicked multiple times. He got rocked on a lot of different occasions. He did get eye pokes, so it's not a loss on his record, but I think it is fair to say that if that fight was going the way that it was going up until that point, Leon Edwards was definitely in the driver's seat, but it has been really nice to see that Bilal Muhammad hasn't got away from his striking, even though he did struggle with it against Leon Edwards. Because that's fair to say, anybody in the UFC is probably going to struggle with pure striking as Leon Edwards. Alex Pereira, Israel Adesanya, those are about the only guys who won't. Like, of course, there's other guys on the list, but you get the idea that's how good Leon is. It's been nice to see that Bilal didn't get away from that style, even against Damian Maia, Stephen Wonderboy Thompson,
and Vicente Luque in the rematch.
And that was a weird fight, because, again, you guys know I like boxing. I tuned in for Devin Haney versus George Campbell. Cambosos 1 and 2 that just happened last night. Now, I remember a lot of people after the first George Haney performance saying, hey, he won, but it was boring. You know, like, he could have done more. I don't care. Like, Bilal Muhammad faced that same criticism after he beat Vicente Luque. It was, hey, he didn't beat him in a firefight brawl in the middle of the cage. I've got news for you guys. Nobody beats Vicente Luque in that style of a fight. Bilal Muhammad was able to use his MMA game beautifully. He struck with Luque. He put question marks in Luque's head. He took him down. That's the version of Bilal Muhammad. And this might be a bit of a hot take. I don't think he could beat Kamaru Usman. I don't think he could beat Colby Covington just outright. Like, I'm not going to sit here and say that. I think it'd be a pretty competitive fight, though, at this stage of his career, with the improvements we've seen in the striking, with how good I know his gas tank is, and with the wrestling that we always know is there. I really do think that if Bilal Muhammad's able to get past another very tough test in Sean Brady, who I've barely spent any time talking about, he should get another one of those Fight Night main events or another big opponent his next time.
Yeah, this is a giant step up for Brady. And the other thing about Muhammad, he's obviously moving back down in terms of the rankings, taking a fight like this against a guy like Brady. And of course, this is your main event of the prelims. This is the main event of free TV, as they're going to call it. But for Sean Brady, he's so, so dominant with his grappling. When he wants to take you down, he gets the takedown. And doing that against a guy like Michael Chiesa, doing that early as a pro against a guy like Aaron Jeffrey, who I mentioned earlier on in the show, doing it against guys like Colton Smith, and then he didn't have a good UFC run, but he still beat him on the regional scene.
Robert Whittaker.
A guy like Gilbert Urbina, those wins hold weight coming up into the UFC, and it's good to see that level of competition then translate into this dominance that we've seen at 15-0 already. It's not often that you see runs like this, and you've seen from Sean Brady, steadies behind the jab. That really does set up all of his offense. He's not a big time kicker. He will wing a right hand out there every now and again, but constantly looking to change the level in all of his fights.
I know we normally talk about odds a little bit at the end, but I really wanted to ask you this question while we're still kind of looking at them on Tapology. Sean Brady right now is like a minus 140, minus 150.
Open, hold on. Bilal Muhammad opened as a minus 225 favorite. He's a plus 120 underdog. For Sean Brady, open plus 190, he's a minus 145
And that's
favorite.
The question that I wanted to ask you. So I think we're both in agreement for a large part of this fight. I think the striking favors Muhammad. The wrestling is pretty close, if we're being honest. Both guys can have a lot of success in that area. But I would favor Brady with the grappling if he is able to get on top of Muhammad. The thing is, with Brady being the favorite, do you think the people who are putting money on this fight or the odds makers just really think that, okay, if he does get that top position, he's going to have a lot of success with it? Because I don't see it that way. I really do think Muhammad is squirmy enough off his back, is going to move enough and have the type of cardio that's really going to make Sean Brady work for those good positions that he's able to get in. But when I look at Sean Brady being the favorite, I just put my mindset into people who are putting money on Sean Brady, and I think, okay, you would have to assume Brady is very dominant in that top position, where just me, Matthew Allen of Fight Night Picks, I think he's going to have good work there, don't get me wrong, if he gets the spot, but I don't think we're just going to see a 10-8 round because Sean Brady got on top of Bilal Muhammad.
Fight Night Picks fans are Sean Brady fans. Fight Night Picks fans are not Bilal Muhammad fans. So,
but you know what I mean? Like, I find it very odd to see the guy who's a lot less proven in the division be the favorite.
Well, you do look at it in terms of the Tapology votes. Surprise to us, it is to you. We'll go over to Tapology to see those. I'm going to say over under 75% Brady.
I think they'll be under.
I think the fan support's there, and it's close. So 1,262 total votes, 57% Brady, 74% by decision for the 43% that have Muhammad, 87% by decision. I think Sean Brady, from what we've seen in the UFC, has three-round cardio. So it'll be, you know,
and that's a really good point, because in a five-round fight, I would definitely favor Bilal Muhammad, but in a three-round fight, it definitely makes it more interesting.
And for me, Muhammad's only been taken down by Jordan Meehan for a short period of time, and also Damian Maia for, what, like 2 seconds in their fight?
That fight was so bad.
Yeah, 1 of 21 was Damian Maia on his takedown attempts. Bilal Muhammad has been like a wet blanket to the takedowns. Is he more offensive when he earns his own takedown versus Sean Brady? No. Sean Brady is like glue on the mat when it does come to his own grappling. And Enzo Gracie Philly, you want to be like Joe Pyfer, you can't pick against Sean Brady. That is a real thing that actually does exist in the world. But when it comes down to this matchup, Matt, we talk more about Bilal Muhammad, but Sean Brady is the hotness as a prospect.
He really is, and he does deserve that right. Like, I understand why he's the favorite. He's had a lot of really impressive performances, and if we're having that kind of peak and valleys conversation, I would say the peaks of Sean Brady, even though he hasn't had the level of competition that Bilal Muhammad has, he definitely has looked better in some sports. Like, the dominance that Sean Brady has shown in the top position is Bilal Muhammad's never been able to show that one level of dominance in his fight.
If you can do it against the Crusher, Court McGee, and you can drop him, there's a chance you can do the same thing against Bilal Muhammad.
But that's my problem with Sean Brady. It does feel like his game is slightly one note, and if he isn't able to get that takedown offensively, then his opponent won't be as worried about the takedown attempt. They're going to be able to open up a lot more with their striking, and I'm someone who's been pretty high on Pat Sabatini in the past, but I do feel like Sean Brady is Pat Sabatini at, like, maybe not his Hall of Fame level, but like his All-NBA level, if you will. They both are a little bit basic on the feet, but we know how good they are once they get into the mat. I think there's a world out there where I'm going to look dumb and Sean Brady could get like a ground and pound TKO over Bilal Muhammad, because physically he really is that dominant at this weight class. But I do find myself picking the underdog in Bilal Muhammad. I like his footwork, and I really do think that's going to be a big key in this fight. I think his footwork is going to allow him to get in and out of range, and I think that's going to allow Bilal Muhammad to be the one to dictate when the wrestling exchanges are being happening. I really struggle with that. But for Sean Brady, again, I think that one position he has is as good as anything Bilal has. I just think Bilal's more well-rounded.
Muhammad training with Valley Flow Striking System is regular gym. Lewis Taylor, you will see there. But they're also training in Abu Dhabi with Habib Nurmagomedov and every single person in that entourage.
And they know how to grapple.
The pictures on Instagram, it's like the few from Valley Flow, there's probably like four of them, and then like 50 guys out of Habib's team. So a big time matchup. Both of us going with Bilal Muhammad to get the win coming up this weekend. You will disagree with us in the comments section.
It's a really good fight.
And I want to hear your reasoning why. Let us know down below in the comments. We have a big time main card. We're live with the Sidekick on Saturday. We're live with Question Mark Kicks 2 hours before the prelims. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Kicking off the main card of UFC 280, the former EFC flyweight champ, the beast, Manon Fiorot. Oui, c'est comment c'est prononcé. She's taking on the former bantamweight and flyweight CFFC champ, blonde fighter. Describe yourself, Caitlin Chookagian. Matt, I'm going to assume that the commenters underneath this video, about 80 to 90% of them, are going to want to see new blood in the women's flyweight division. They want to see a new matchup for Valentina Shevchenko, and they're all going to pick Manon Fiorot. You agree with that one?
I would agree with that, but I got to be honest. If you just want to ask me at my most casual how I would like this fight to go, I'm not going to lie. I'd love there be a new power puncher to go up against Valentina Shevchenko, but I agree with what your sentiment is on that point. I think a lot of people are going to try to favor the, I shouldn't even say younger, because they are fairly close in age, but the newer commodity, the more power punching of the two in Manon Fiorot.
For Manon Fiorot, it has been talked about for as long as we've known about her, the fact that she is a striking dynamo. Obviously, we know the sidekick, we know the combinations with the boxing, how good she is at closing distance, and hey, how about her last time out against Jennifer Maia, where you'd think Maia would excel on the ground? Fiorot was the one that was initiating the takedowns in the fight. She was dominant, as we've seen her, except for maybe the finish that she had against Victoria Leonardo. But for Fiorot, looked very good against the former title challenger her last time out and picked up a giant win. Now, all of a sudden, you're the seventh-ranked women's flyweight in Fiorot, taking on the perennial one to the champion in Caitlin Chookagian, always the bridesmaid, never the bride, gets another opportunity here to turn away a likely contender in Fiorot.
Caitlin Chookagian slowly becoming the Derek Brunson of this division. Now, it hasn't happened just yet, and Derek Brunson went from being ranked third to being ranked eight somehow, but
she's today's Robert Whittaker.
Robert Whittaker, I think, could still maybe beat Israel Adesanya. I don't think there's a chance in hell that Caitlin Chookagian ever beats Valentina Shevchenko. But I'll go back to my, like, presenting voice now. The thing about Chookagian is, and I think you'll agree with me on this, she just knows how to beat contenders at this point. It is nice to see, and it does feel like we do have a few different divisions that have these number one contender B, if you will. There is Robert Whittaker, for instance, at middleweight. You've got Colby Covington at welterweight. There are some fighters now who it's like, okay, I've beaten everybody but the champion. How much more do I have to do to finally get another shot at the title? And for Chookagian, it is kind of weird because she's not a finisher. So for Chookagian, I think it is going to be really hard to prove to the UFC, okay, I've made this big of a step so that now it is going to be competitive against me and Shevchenko. But that's the fun thing about this fight. Let's see, you are really convinced that Manon Fiorot is the new hotness. And I'll be honest, I wasn't 100% sold on her. I was 90% sold on her until her last matchup against Jennifer Maia, because we all know how talented of a fighter Maia is. I would argue that until Tyler Santos fought Valentina Shevchenko, Maia was probably the most competitive with her outside of Joanna, and Joanna's one of the greatest female fighters we've ever seen. So I definitely agree with where a lot of fans are coming from. I personally also agree. Like, would it be exciting to see Manon Fiorot versus Valentina Shevchenko? Of course. But do you know what I really like about Caitlin Chookagian and why she's that great number one contender and a half? She's good at everything. You are going to get tested in that one area of your game that Valentina Shevchenko isn't going to test. She's going to exploit and then finish you by it. Like, if Manon Fiorot does have terrible takedown defense or does really struggle off her back in sort of the more elongated exchanges, the Caitlin Chookagian does have the skill set that can really find that hole in your game. We all know how good her volume striking is on the back foot, but it wasn't that long ago she was going for a lot of offensive takedowns against Antonina Shevchenko. And I know Antonina's not the best fighter in the division, but still, the fact that Chookagian was able to show us just that other part of her game to where we know how good of a striker you are, now we know how good you are at grappling at the UFC level, that gave me more confidence in Chookagian, at least in this matchup.
Chookagian came into the UFC in 2016. She's 11-4 in that time. She did get the title shot in 15 total UFC fights. She's the favorite. She was the underdog against Valentina Shevchenko. She was the underdog against Antonina Shevchenko. The underdog against Jessica Andrade. Yeah. And the underdog against Cynthia Calvillo. So only as of recently, Chookagian's been an underdog. And this is split between bantamweight and flyweight. Don't forget that.
And she brought good fighters in the bantamweight division, too.
Yeah, and she's 2-2 in those underdog spots. So good opportunity for her. Whereas Manon Fiorot has been a big favorite in every single UFC fight. Minus 200 against Leonardo, finishes her. Minus 550 against Tabitha Ricci, finishes her. Minus 275 against Maeda Buena Silva, decisions her. And then against one Jennifer Maia, minus 510. Like, that seems wild, but that was it. So in this pairing, Fiorot opened a -115. She's a minus 208. Chookagian open as the underdog. She's still the underdog at a plus 180. So minus 210, Fiorot will call it, and plus 180 for Chookagian. We have a look at the fan vote, Matt. Again, it is a surprise to us, it is to you, and I've been good at setting these over-unders tonight, but I will say for Fiorot, I feel like she's going to have the fan support. Everybody's going to be there. I'm going to say over-under 70%, though.
I think it'll be under.
You think it's going to be under? It's slightly over. 1,124 total votes, 72% Fyodor, 74% par décision, puis pour Caitlin Chookagan, 28%, puis 86% par décision pour Chookagan. I don't know why they've gone with Manon Fjord. I don't know where that came from, because I've heard her say her own name multiple times, say Fyodor. But regardless, Matt, what is the pick here? Because you talked about it. Chookagan with the wrestling, we've seen the improvement. Belmore kickboxing, she's a Henzo Gracie fighter. If you do look at it for Chookagan, great volume striking forward and backward. Fyodor, a little bit more pop on those shots. Also very good at striking backwards and forwards. Also like the tennis player that is when she strikes, because there's the big ha-ha when she does it. But for you, what is the pick here?
I'm going to compare Manon Fyodor to Derek Jeter. And just sit with me for 2 seconds. Derek Jeter, a lot of people who don't like the Yankees just say he's the most overrated player of all time. He's very overrated. That's a term you'll hear thrown around with him quite a bit. And I look at Manon Fyodor a lot like Derek Jeter, and please hear me out. She has been the big favorite in all of her fights, but what has she not proven that she's supposed to be? Like, Manon Fyodor has always been able to demonstrate the exact same skill set, no matter who the opponent is. Think about Amanda Lemos, who I would say, honestly, stylistically, has a lot of the same positives that Manon Fyodor has. The difference is, Amanda Lemos has run into volume strikers where she's had trouble with. She's run into some wrestlers that she's had trouble with. Fyodor, she hasn't really disproven the fact that she should be a favorite in a lot of her fights. So I'm going to be honest. I really thought I'd come into this video thinking, oh, Caitlin Chookagan is going to win this fight. Because like I said, the experience is on her side. She just knows how to win these fights. And I know that's a weird thing to say, but just think of yourself in any situation you've ever been in life. The first time you do it, you're probably going to be a little bit anxious about it. You know what happens the second time you do it? You just think about the first time you did it, and you don't worry about all the unknowns.
Matt's talking about blasting.
Just talk about anything, honestly. Talk about blasting if you want to. But that's my whole point. Just like, the first time you do get in with the big dogs, if you will, you're going to face that anxiety. Where with Fyodor, I feel like she has been able to fight at least a title challenger in the past. I think that's a big hurdle to get over. Because if Fyodor just went from beating the Victoria Leonardos of the world, but finishing them, don't get me wrong, to fighting Caitlin Chookagan, I'd be a lot more worried about Fyodor if that was the case, if that was the jump up in competition. But I really do feel like she showed me enough in her last time out against Jennifer Maia to make me confident in picking her in this matchup. Now again, I can't throw up enough red flags, because I really do think Caitlin Chookagan is a valid opponent and one of the best litmus tests for anybody in any division, if we're being honest. Like, that's how high I think of Caitlin Chookagan. But I do think this is the time where Manon Fyodor, it is time for her to finally fight for the title. And I think if she's able to beat Chookagan, she will.
Fyodor's lone loss in her pro debut, a loss by split decision to Bellator superstar Liam McCourt. Exactly. That one was at a catch weight of 138 pounds, which Fyodor's at a disadvantage there. Chookagan, not a weight bully, but she was a former bantamweight in her own right. But we do have a look at this one. Fyodor, positive 4.08 strike differential in the UFC. That's massive. Chookagan obviously throws great volume, but I do like Manon Fyodor in this matchup to mix it up. I think this is a great pairing. You're not wrong until Saturday. So let us know down below in that comment section. We've been talking about you the whole time, yeah, except for the blasting part. So let us know who you have in this matchup. Some big time fights on this main card. Let's break it down. Gamrot, Dariush, Jan O'Malley. Two title fights. Holy smokes.
What is there not to like?
Lightweight. What is there not to like? The Sidekick is live on Saturday night, so listen, keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Coming up this weekend on the main card of UFC 280, we have a possible title eliminator between the former double champ over with KSW, Gamer Mataush Gamrot. He's taking on Benny and the Jets, Benil Dariush. And we look at this matchup, and you have a couple of guys that do both things very well. I mean, both guys very good grapplers, both guys very good strikers. They put on very, very fun fights. And for Dariush, he suffered a couple of setbacks. Like, I think back to the time he had the draw against Evan Dunham, and then a couple of fights later, he gets finished by Alexander Hernandez, and also a loss to Edson Barboza. And the questions are, is this guy Chinny? Can he really have some tough fights? And my goodness, has he ever proved that in the last little bit, especially like, what, the Holtzman fight or the fight that he had against Jakar Close? Oh, this guy can chuck some leather.
Well, that's the good thing about Benil Dariush. He is so skilled as a mixed martial artist that it doesn't really matter what his liabilities are when it comes to his durability in his game. Because we have seen, especially early on in his career, he was able to get clipped by shots, get hurt, and not really be able to recover as a result of them. But throughout his recent tenure, Even think back, like, this is a real quote from Benil Dariush. It was, I got hurt by a Tony Ferguson upkick. You go back to the Ferguson fight, he gets hit by an upkick, kind of goes down in one of those weird, awkward ways where you don't really know if he's just, like, jumping in the guard or if he got hurt. But if you listen to Dariush, he openly admits, like, I got hurt in that fight. But if you also watch that fight, Benil Dariush looks pretty darn good grappling in the matchup. But I really do think, and this is a weird thing to say, but this fight and what your prediction is on this fight really comes down to what your thoughts are of Tony Ferguson at this stage of his career. And if you want to disagree with me, please feel free to. But let's say you think Tony Ferguson is the guy who he showed in the first round against Michael Chandler. He's confident, he has striking, he can go out there, land his own power shots, because again, we're only thinking about the first round, not the front kick round. That's a really good fighter. Like, that's a fighter who I think would give troubles to a lot of guys in the top 15. But the problem is, and again, you can make this argument too, and I can't really disagree with you, is, hey, he's also lost four straight fights in a row, so how good was he at any singular point?
And that's the thing. I mean, you look at it, for Charles Oliveira, passed the test, wins the title. For Benil Dariush, passed the test with flying colors. Does he get a title fight? No. Does he get a fight against Islam Makhachev in a main event? Yeah. And then he broke his fibula and had an ankle injury, and then decided to kind of let it heal on its own. So it seemed like Dariush, they were going to try and remake that Makhachev fight. Makhachev fights Bobby Green, and now he gets a title shot off the Bobby Green fight. So Dariush is left on the back burner. Now, the injury that he did sustain earlier on this week, it was one of those ones where you break that, it's the long bone in your leg that goes down to your ankle. And then with the advice of doctors consulting, 6 to 8 week recovery, if he just kind of let it heal on its own.
Surprisingly fast.
Went that way. And then, well, it's been a lot more than 6 to 8 weeks before we've seen him ready for action. And I go down through his overall record again. You look at the way that Dariush has been winning these fights. The Holtzman fight, the win against Shakara Close. Really giving it his all, and it's blood and guts performances. And I know you can draw parallels from both the Hot Sauce Holtzman fights, because Gamrot also fought him and also beat him impressively. But when you look at both of these guys, obviously great grappling, great wrestling, everything that goes on with a well-rounded skill set. For Mateusz Gamrot, ADCC European champion just as recently as 2019, to go with a great freestyle wrestling base. But oh wait, he goes for ankle picks for takedowns and odd angle things as well. Both these guys, again, skill for skill, very well-rounded. Who's the harder puncher? Who throws more volume? I think Dariush, hits a lot harder. I think Gamrot throws a lot better volume. But for the people that didn't believe in Gamrot, he was about a plus 200 underdog against Armon Tsarukyan his
last
time.
That was my question.
Out.
Do you think he won that fight? It was close.
I thought Tsarukyan won.
Fair. That was my question, because that's the thing. That's one of those fights where I don't care what, like, that was as close as a fight could possibly be. But we didn't see Gamrot get hurt by a strike in that fight. We saw him struggle with some of the wrestling. And you're Benil Dariush, you can kind of recreate a game plan similar to that.
You go back and watch the Gamrot fight. I'll preface it by saying this. MMA decisions, which I'll reference, if you look at it, 7 scored at 48-47 for Gamrot. 12 scored at 48-47 Tsarukyan, 2 scored at 49-46 Tsarukyan, 1 scored at 50-45 Tsarukyan. But in that fourth round, it was a spinning back fist from Tsarukyan that dropped Gamrot, and the commentary didn't even react to it. It was almost like, hey, Gamrot fell down. And then on the rewatch, that was a spinning back fist that landed flush. So it was a knockdown for Tsarukyan. I thought Gamrot, obviously, not just getting the win, but proved a lot of people, not necessarily wrong, but hey, this guy really is on that 100%. Level. He really shut down the Uber prospect in just getting that win. But it was a very tightly contested fight.
And that was just going to be my point. Like, I don't care if you thought Gamrot won or lost that fight. He had a really competitive fight against another one of the most skilled guys in the division. I just think that's a great litmus test for, okay, now you can go on to fight other guys who are ranked. The thing is, Benil Dariush has been in there with some of the best fighters, arguably of all time, not even of just our generation.
So like Evan Dunham,
exactly. But I was very interested to see, how does Gamrot do if he's not able to get the initial takedown attempt on Dariush? Because I really do think Benil is the more skilled fighter on the feet. Now, to be fair, you couldn't say that his whole career, but the Kings MMA transformation that Benil Dariush has been able to make, and I know he's been with them for a large portion of his career, this is not a change that happened overnight, but you can definitely see the improvements that his striking has taken over his UFC tenure. And I always go back, it's wild. Benil Dariush lost to Michael Chiesa at 155 pounds. He got choked out by him. A lot of people forget about that fight. But Michael Chiesa has to be respected as one of those, like, top-tier grapplers. That's how good he is. A lot of people forget it. Or a lot of people just remember the weird, did he tap, did he not, to Kevin Lee.
Talk about my mom.
But I look at this fight, and I do think that Gamrot, okay, he struggled in some of the striking with Armin Tsarukyan, who admittedly is faster than Dariush probably, but I wouldn't say he's the technician that Dariush is on the feet. I just don't know what Gamrot's answer is going to be other than trying to brawl on the feet, because I do think Dariush is more technical from a longer range. I think he can use the kicks a lot more to his benefit, because we've seen Dariush go to the body, go to the leg with his kicks. Not a huge head kicker. He'll do it every now and then because he is such a good grappler. He doesn't really worry about what he's throwing, but I just don't know how Gamrot's going to make this fight close on the feet if he isn't able to get the takedown.
I do like the accumulation of volume, and I think in a three-round fight, that's conducive for a guy like Mateusz Gamrot. And if you do look at it, I mean, you consider Gamrot just in the UFC in a vacuum. Guram Kutatuladze, he loses that fight by split decision. I thought Gamrot beat Kutatuladze, and I thought he lost to Armin Tsarukyan. So take that for what it's worth. But both of those fights are fight of the nights. He's got a performance bonus against Hot Sauce Holtzman. He's got a performance bonus against Jeremy Stephens, where he just finished him lickety-split and sent him packing. That's for so the fast. PFL. And then his other win is against Diego Faeno, who has a more impressive win. Benil won by split decision. Mateusz kneed him kind of as he had his back and broke his rib, and then tried to choke him out.
Different points in his career, though.
Tried to end it. But if you do consider the odds in this matchup, Dariush opened a plus 135 underdog. He's about a plus 160 for Gamrot. He's gained open minus 155, minus 195 right now. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprised us they are to you, but I'm going to say over under 65% Gamrot, the former KSW.
I think they'll be close to 50-50. I really do.
Look at that, 1,239 total votes on Tapology, 69% going with Mateusz Gamrot to get the win, 74% by decision. For the 31% that have Dariush, 70% by decision. I don't know how that leg healed. I have no friggin' clue.
That's the thing. If there wasn't an extended layoff for Benil Dariush, I think this is as 50-50 of a fight as there is on, entire card.
You had mentioned Dariush. Not just does he have good takedown defense, can he play baseball, Matt? He has 81% takedown defense in the UFC.
And the guy's a black belt in jiu-jitsu, and it's not like a fake made-up one. Like, this guy can submit you.
Evan Dunham was the last guy to get a takedown on Benil Dariush, and if you go back to that fight, that was back in 2017, before Dariush beat Thiago Moises, Drew Dober, Frank Camacho, Jacare Clos, Scott Holtzman, Diego Faeja, and Tony Ferguson. So Matt, we round out the video here. I think he kind of shaded it a little bit, but what's the pick in the matchup?
I wanted to pick Benil Dariush. Again, I came into this video thinking, okay, he's the more technical guy on the feet. He's the younger guy is what I was going to say, but just in terms of fight years, because I've seen Gamrot get into some wars.
Oh, KSW Norman Park fights?
Exactly. And that's the thing about Gamrot. Even in the UFC, though, Guram dropped him multiple times. He'd been dropped by Armin. Like, Gamrot's been hit in the head enough times for me to think, okay, Dariush definitely has enough knockout power to drop Gamrot and probably hurt him. The opposite also has to be said, though. I've seen Dariush get hurt enough times in the feet for me to think, okay, if Gamrot does sit down on a big hook, he can probably hurt him. So then it really comes down to the grappling. And I gotta be honest, both these guys are phenomenal when it comes down to the grappling. They're both good wrestlers. They're both good at exchanges on the mat. They're both good at scrambling. I'm really just trying to give myself more time to make an official prediction, but I am going to make the official one. Ever so slightly going to pick Mateusz Gamrot based on his last performance. I like enough what I saw in the grappling, defending the takedowns from a guy like Armin Tsarukyan, for me to think that Gamrot's going to be able to fight this fight on his terms. Now, I don't know if his terms are going to be on the mat or on the feet, but I do think Gamrot has the better wrestling to be able to decide which one is going to be contested at, and that's why I ever so slightly picked Gamrot. But you could tell me absolutely anything in the next 30 seconds, and it might completely change my opinion.
The level of activity for Gamer is something that I really like. The level of competition that he gets to skill check against at American Top Team really is where it's at. For Dariush, it's been great. There's all sorts of good fighters that come in and out of Kings MMA. The last time we saw him, a year and 4 months ago, the leg injury, how's it healed? How will he look after the time away? All question marks that I do have. If you have a good case for the big underdog, or he's not that big of an underdog, but for the underdog in Benil Dariush, let us know down below. Please, in the comments section. I like the wrestling, the oddity of the different takedown attempts that you'll get out of Gamrot, and the motor that he has in a lot of these fights as a reason why I will go with picking him. But again, volume for Gamrot, I love it. Dariush with the punching power, that can really be the equalizer. So let us know down below in the comments section who you have. Both of us going with Poland's KSW's former double champ, Mateusz Gamrot, to get the win. Matt, it's time. Piotr Jan, Sean O'Malley.
Incredible fight.
You got two title fights up at the top. You're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
The official weight for Piotr Jan.
big time bantamweight pairing on the main card of UFC 280. We have No Mercy Piotr Jan taking on Sugar Sean O'Malley. And holy smokes, I mean, possible title implications in this matchup for Piotr Jan. He's fighting down in the rankings against Sean O'Malley, who has a giant shot coming off a no contest where he eye-poked Pedro Munhoz and scratched that cornea, tickled the old eyeball of that small, small Brazilian man. And for Sean O'Malley, this really is a good step up in competition. I mean, you look at it for him, it's been the slow burn since he debuted in the UFC off Dana White's Contender Series 2017. He goes from fighting Alfred Kashakian to Tarion Ware to then all of a sudden facing some better competition. And for Piotr Jan, coming off a split decision loss in the title fight, the rematch against Aljamain Sterling, where maybe it was a little controversial that it was a split due to the fact that Sterling had so much success with just kind of backpacking Piotr Jan for long periods of time in that fight. But for Jan, this is either a good opportunity to get back to the basics, work in your boxing, or it's the opportunity for Sean O'Malley to maybe finally show some of those grappling chops. Obviously, you're going to have Tim Welch in the corner, but a lot of pictures over on Instagram with Augusto Mendes, a guy who was known to get it done at the ADCCs, if you know what I mean. But if you look at it on Instagram, Piotr Jan, 1.5 million Instagram followers. Sean O'Malley, one up you. Checkmate, 2.5 million. And it looks like for O'Malley, acclimatizing himself over in Abu Dhabi. He was over at that the preseason NBA games over there. For Piotr Jan, getting it done at Tiger Muay Thai, the OG gym, Zubair Tukugov also there, and he's on this card as well. So Matt, I love the pairing. I think it's a very, very fun fight, a possible fight of the night if I've ever seen one. And also, both these guys featured in a thumbnail for this one.
And this is the weird thing about this fight. I know a lot of people are going to look at the result that Piotr Jan had against Aljamain Sterling, say, oh, split decision, it must have been a close fight. But like you had said, it wasn't really. Like, I didn't think Jan had a great performance in that fight whatsoever. And honestly, up until that fight, I was like, okay, if he fought Sean O'Malley, like, what are we doing? Like, they better have a ton of ambulances and paramedics waiting out back, because that's how much better Piotr Jan is. But he did look a little bit tentative in his last fight against Aljamain Sterling, especially after Sterling was able to get a lot of those takedowns. Now, to be fair, Sean O'Malley is a good grappler. He does have good jiu-jitsu, but the difference is he doesn't necessarily have the pure wrestling chops that a guy like Aljamain Sterling has to go out there and chain wrestle you and really have a lot of these elongated grappling exchanges with you like Aljamain Sterling can. And that's the thing that I have to keep on going back to. Piotr Jan has barely shown weakness in the UFC up until that Aljamain Sterling fight. And that does have to be, like, I know he had the illegal strike against Aljo too, but like, Piotr Jan, other than those Aljo fights, well, who's ever beat him striking? Nobody. Like,
he got rocked by John Dodson and Jin Susan at a competitive fight in a fight of the night.
And then he beat the brakes off John Dodson and showed up to a fight against Jose Aldo. And it was like the hardest thing I've ever had to watch. Like, I like Jose Aldo because I've been growing up watching a lot of MMA. Piotr Jan didn't like Jose Aldo at all. He didn't grow up watching him. And that's the problem I have with breaking down this fight. I feel like the people who are picking Sean O'Malley are trying to find faith in some of those Aljo performances and trying to find an area that Sean O'Malley can at least replicate and have some similar success in. And I'm telling you right now, I think Sean O'Malley's good at jiu-jitsu. I think he's a good grappler. Piotr Jan has incredible takedown defense, though, and unless you do have the ability to really chain wrestle and go for the single legs and the double legs up against the cage and really make him think about his takedown attempts, think about every other takedown Piotr Jan's ever defended in the UFC. Think about Jimmy Rivera, a guy who's a very talented wrestler in his own right. He would go for takedowns, have wrestling exchanges, if you will, to where they're on the feet, they're kind of wrestling for position, and then what would happen? Piotr Jan would create distance and hit him with his own power shots. But since I bring up the Jimmy Rivera fight, I might as well bring up this other point, which might help Sean O'Malley. Piotr Jan lost 14 and a half minutes of that fight, if being completely honest, but he won 10 seconds in every single round. It was the last 10 seconds of every round where he drops Jimmy Rivera and really hurts him. I know that might be a bit of an exaggeration, but there are two versions of Piotr Jan. There is the I'm downloading your game plan, Jan, and then there's I have your game plan downloaded, Jan, and it's really going to be interesting to see when does he download that game plan, because the last time we saw him have a lot of success against a tall, rangy striker, it was Corey Sandhagen, and we all know how good he is and how skilled he is on the feet. Sean O'Malley and Corey Sandhagen share a lot of similarities. Now, to be fair, Sandhagen likes to get in the pocket and then throw a lot of punches once he's in the pocket, whereas O'Malley is going to make you come to him and try to hit you with power shots, but they do share a lot of similarities in their MMA game.
And the other thing for Sean O'Malley versus Piotr Jan, if you do want to go towards Sugar Sean, if you look at Jan, he does take that Floyd Mayweather approach to a lot of his fights. Figure things out, wait as it goes, and then all of a sudden boom goes the dynamite, and Piotr Jan's having a lot of success. And it is a style that's very conducive to five rounds. Former ACB champ, former UFC bantamweight champ. Little asterisk there. I bet TJ Dillashaw wasn't happy that Piotr Jan was a bantamweight
I'd
champ.
I'd love to see Jan and Dillashaw in the future.
But if you look at it for O'Malley, he does like to get work done very, very quickly. And you look at it in terms of the all-time UFC ranks. All-time. Every weight class. He is number 5 all-time with a 62.4% strike accuracy. Number 3 all-time with a 4.49 strike differential. Number 2 all-time in 7.83 strikes landed per minute. The level of competition has gone up incrementally over a long period of time for O'Malley versus Jan, who it was what it was, and then all of a sudden it was the deep end. So for O'Malley, he could be in his Piotr Jan phase, but for Sean O'Malley, his last time against Pedro Munhoz, I'll admit it. I didn't pick Sean O'Malley to beat Pedro Munhoz, who was like a plus 260 underdog, because I thought that Pedro Munhoz would have a ton of success with the leg kicks, and boy was boy was I right in the first round of that fight, because Matt, Pedro Munhoz landed 26 total strikes in that fight. He went 26 of 41 in terms of significant strikes. It's a decent percentage. And every single one of those strikes was leg kicks. All 26 were leg kicks. First round, Munhoz won. A lot of people were like, Craig, you're insane.
It was close, to be fair. Neither guy really pulled apart.
In the second round, Sean O'Malley started to pull away. He started to have a lot of success distancing himself away, landing his jab, and then landing his finger in Pedro's eye. And if you don't believe it, well, Zai was swollen shut and he had a scratched cornea. So it was legit. But Matt, when we look at this matchup, for jiu-jitsu's sake, Sean O'Malley has it. For the master of sport in boxing and mixed martial arts, Piotr Jan can really mix it up with the best of them. The best part for Jan is his pitter-patter in and out to mix in his boxing combinations and to go from the body to the head. It might look a little comical in our picture there, the height discrepancy. It is only 4 inches, but the hair adds some volume for Sean.
There's a part of me that thinks Piotr Jan is going to fight this fight like he fought Andrade da Silva. Silva de Andrade. He got on top of him, got him into crucifix, and ground and pounded him into the ground. Like, just kept on taking him down and really showcased his own offensive grappling. That's the thing about Piotr Jan. Even if you are low on him based on his last performance and getting out grappled by Aljamain Sterling, Aljamain Sterling is a UFC championship caliber fighter.
And a collegiate wrestler to boot.
And also specializes with his grappling. So if anybody's going to out-grapple you, it's probably going to be someone like Aljamain Sterling. When you think about Sean O'Malley's game at the championship level, you probably don't think about Sean O'Malley triangle choking a lot of guys off his back or getting a lot of rear naked chokes. Yes, he can get those techniques, but a lot of the times that's going to be a result of him hurting his opponent and then following up with a submission or something like that. I just don't think Sean O'Malley can go out there and really control Piotr Jan for a lot of time, and if that's the case, it means he's gonna have to have success in his striking. Now I think he can, because he is so tall and rangy for this division. We all know how good his punching power can be, but Piotr Jan's not a guy who gets hit clean all that much. Like, I know you bring it up, he got rocked by John Dodson on a weird in-between shot up against the cage, but John Dodson is some of the best punching speed at least we've ever seen up until that point. And the one blip on the radar is enough for me to really worry that this is going to become some overall issue with Piotr Jan in every fight he's going to have.
Matt, if you have a look at the odds in this matchup, Jan open minus 250 favorite, minus 313 as it stands now in best fight odds. For Sean O'Malley, opened up a plus 210. He's plus 245. We have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us as they are to you. I'm going to say over 77.5%.
I think it'll be over for Jan.
It's going to be over. Oh boy, it's slightly over. 1,292 total votes, 79% Jan, 38% by decision, 55% by knockout. For the 21% that have O'Malley, 43% by decision, 47% by knockout. Again, like Letter, Kenny, Pitter Patter, let's get at her. I think Piotr Jan's going to have success on the in and out and the in-betweens with his boxing. Sean O'Malley, I didn't bring up those all-time UFC record numbers that he has for no reason. He also has great volume. It's just in some of these exchanges, I see Jan winning out. I also like the stance switches and the leg kicks, and I can't stress that one enough as a point where I leave on this one.
I agree with you on all the Piotr Jan points. I also have him to win this fight. But I can just see there being a world where Dana White shows up to a press conference looking as red as your shirt going, Sean O'Malley, isn't he fucking awesome? He wants to fight Aljamain in Long Island. I fucking love that kid. I can see it being one of those cases where Dana White's like really trying to pump his tires too much, but I also have Piotr Jan in this matchup.
Both of us going with no mercy. Piotr Jan, Make sure you tune in at the Fight Night Picks Sidekick live for the main card. We'll be in action. Maybe we'll have a couple of Colorado Kool-Aids with us as we tune in for this big-time card. Two title fights up at the top. You're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Big time bantamweight title fight. It's on the line. We have the Funkmaster, Aljamain Sterling, taking on that snake in the grass, TJ Dillashaw, in an all-time bantamweight matchup. And if you told me that this fight was going to happen 2 or 3 years ago, I couldn't contain myself. I would have been like rock hard with an emotion. I've got a phoner like Jake Hager when he was with Bellator. I absolutely love this pairing nonetheless. You have the former two-time bantamweight champ Dillashaw looking to make good and become a three-time champ. That stuff doesn't happen all the time. And for Aljamain Sterling, prove the doubters wrong, ourselves included, and probably you as well, unless you were an alumnus of Cortland or, you know, somebody on Long Island, because man, did Sterling ever look good his last time out against Piotr Jan, Matt?
I mean, he's looked good in his whole string of fights leading up to his title shot and of course him becoming champion. But that's been the great thing about Aljamain Sterling. It feels like he added to his game in segments as he's been a UFC fighter. It's been really nice to see, because for the longest part we knew how good his volume was, we knew how good his wrestling was, but it really did feel like he was another case of a Gilbert Burns, where it's like, okay, we know how skilled you are in every one area of mixed martial arts. It'd be really nice for you to pull them all together though. And after he did suffer that brutal knockout loss to Marlon Moraes, and we're all gonna remember that, he gets dropped by a punch, the ref immediately stands him up, he goes for a takedown, gets hit by a switch kick that kind of becomes a knee, and he gets flatlined. It's a really bad knockout loss, and it was one that made a lot of people reconsider if they ever thought Aljamain Sterling would be able to get to this point in the first place. But the run that he's been able to go on since that knockout loss of Brett Johns, Cody Stamann, Jimmy Rivera, Pedro Munhoz, Corey Sandhagen, and Piotr Jan 1.5 times, let's say, because the first one was disqualification. He more than justified his win over him the second time around, though. It's been really nice to see the evolution of skills throughout Aljamain Sterling. And the first fight that I want to bring up and that I feel like we have to bring up is the Corey Sandhagen submission win. Like,
they're still dry.
Corey Sandhagen is as good as anybody in this division. He can offer a difficult fight to anybody in this division. And we know how good of a grappler he is. He's got out of bad positions in the past and then been able to make them work for himself. Aljamain Sterling doesn't let you get out of bad positions, though, and even proved that in the Jan rematch. In the first Jan fight, Aljo wasn't able to secure a lot of the takedowns, so we never really saw how good his grappling was going to be once the fight did hit the mat and we weren't just in these wrestling exchanges. But in the rematch, we saw how much of a handful Aljamain Sterling can be on the mat. Now, yes, he wasn't able to go out there and submit Piotr Jan, but we saw the similar game that he showed in the Sandhagen fight, where if he gets you to the ground, if he gets your back, there's basically nothing you can do about it. Now, I would even put TJ Dillashaw into that category. He's a very good MMA grappler in his own right, but I don't think TJ Dillashaw's jiu-jitsu, at least, is on the level of a guy like Aljamain Sterling.
No, Aljamain Sterling has great wrestling in MMA, but really, really good lights-out jiu-jitsu when it does come to the mat. Maybe you didn't see that against Piotr Jan, but that also goes to iron sharpening iron and skill for skill. Piotr Jan has pretty darn good submission defense, but for TJ Dillashaw, I've said this for a long stretch of time, even before he went away, best wrestler in MMA to fit his skill set. And when I look at TJ Dillashaw, whether it's winning the belt the first time at UFC 173, finishing Henan Burrell late in that fight, and people are going to forget because Henan went on a BJ Penn-esque run to end his UFC career. Henan was the hotness at one point. He was that hotness. So Dillashaw beats him, takes on an unlikely title challenger in Joe Soto for his first defense, beats him, beats Burrell a second time.
He kind of got lit up a little bit in that fight.
Loses a split decision to Dominic Cruz, and then as he builds himself back up again, ends up dusting Cody Garbrandt, not without facing adversity in both of those fights, but beats Garbrandt 2 times in a row, faces Henry Cejudo at UFC on ESPN Numbrero Uno, and a pre- and post-fight drug test was positive.
When he cried about how the ref had stole the opportunity from him just for him to fail a drug test after, that's when I was like, oh, I'll break down TJ Dillashaw fights, but like, I don't care about.
Well, regardless, he did have a 2-year suspension. He did serve that suspension. His last time out, he beat Corey Sandhagen. Obviously, injuries after that fight, that is the kind of crux of his layoff, and it's been just over a year since he fought Sandhagen. Again, that's a controversial fight. We talked about it, Mateusz Gamrot, his last fight against Armin Tsarukyan, if you want to go back in time and watch our video on Dariush and Gamrot. But the fight that Dillashaw had against Sandhagen, equally controversial. And I kind of thought Sandhagen won in the moment.
It was one of those fights where, again, like, my opinion on it doesn't matter. Either guy could have won. They were both really good. But if you just look at that fight and how both guys contested it, TJ had nothing for Corey on the feet in that fight. Let's just call it what it is. Like, Corey Sandhagen on the feet was a far better striker than TJ Dillashaw. But TJ was able to use his wrestling, be able to go to that well time after time after time, and really wrestle effectively against a guy like Corey Sandhagen. If he tries to do that against Aljamain Sterling, though, I think he's getting absolutely schooled on the mat. And that's the thing about TJ. It really is going to come down to how does he choose to fight this fight. Because I'm going to disagree. Like, I don't think TJ is the greatest MMA wrestler of all time. I think he's a really good one. I think his wrestling suits
him. I think in his day, for a guy that came into MMA, obviously gets kind of entrenched, the Mark Munozes and the Bang Ludwigs of the world.
Dominic Cruz took him down, and they have a very similar background. My whole point is TJ Dillashaw's been out-grappled in the past. He is a really strong grappler, but I think he's almost the opposite that a lot of these really strong grapplers who have success on the feet have. People know how dangerous TJ Dillashaw is, so nobody has their hands down by their side. He throws head kicks and multiple combinations that then end in head kicks. I do think with Dillashaw, and it's not that he's a bad wrestler, again, it's not that he's a bad grappler. I'm not trying to say that whatsoever. I just think the other part of his game is so good, it's so eye-catching, it's so talented, that then it helps him open up that other part of his game. And I'll admit the same on the flip side. Aljamain Sterling, think about his fight against Pedro Munhoz. Yeah, he got kicked in the legs a lot. Looked like a pretty damn good striker to me, though. He's throwing crazy amounts of volume, switching stances, throwing a long jab, using his own kicks. I think Sterling's the opposite. I think Sterling's striking looks a lot better in a lot of cases because guys are so worried about his grappling ability, and I think Dillashaw might almost be the opposite of that. That's all. With Dillashaw, and a lot of people do like to say that he's one of the better MMA grapplers, I think he's really good, but the reason he lost to Dominic Cruz the first time around, I know that was a split decision, but still, he got taken down by Dom a lot in that fight, and he wasn't able to then take down Dominic Cruz.
For Sterling, if you do look at it, he even had those same successes in the early rounds of the first fight against Piotr Jan. It's just, did he blow his load a little bit too early? Well, his pacing looked pretty damn good in the second fight. So if you do consider it for Dillashaw coming into this matchup fresh, he gets the opportunity to fight for the bantamweight strap that he technically never lost in the past. You look at the odds in the matchup. Sterling opened the favorite minus 220, minus 170 right now for Dillashaw, who's gained open plus 185, plus 142 as it stands. We have a look at the total Tapology vote. Surprise to us as they are to you. I'm going to say over under 67.5% for the champ.
I think they'll be close to 50, so I'll say under.
And they're just a little bit under. 1,285 total votes, 64% Sterling, 64% by decision. You've got 28% by submission. For the 36% that have Dillashaw, 60% by decision, 33% by knockout. I think if Dillashaw wins this fight, he knocks out Aljamain Sterling.
That'd be great.
And I think if Sterling wins this fight, it's by decision or by submission. For Dillashaw, I don't know if it was like me trying to dance to Chattahoochee in high school and I'm missing a half beat, but for Dillashaw,
you never knew how much that muddy water meant to you, did
you? His striking just wasn't up to snuff, or it wasn't what I was used to. And again, that could be ring rust. Does it exist? I don't know.
He tore his ACL in the fight too.
But he also did tear that. And if you look at it, his wrestling was still there. But for Sterling, younger fighter, the two-time Division II All-American out of Cortland, I really do like how I've seen the level up from Sterling, whereas for Dillashaw, it was a two-year layoff. Now, he looked pretty fucking good for a guy in a two-year layoff against Corey Sandhagen. But having said that, I do like Aljamain Sterling for the wealth of skills that he possesses here.
My pick is Aljamain Sterling, but I want to get your opinion on this. I think this is the most favorable matchup for TJ Dillashaw out of anybody who could have the title right now.
Killashaw?
But like, I think Piotr Jan is a really hard matchup for TJ Dillashaw. Yeah. I think Marlon Vera, oddly enough, is a really hard matchup for TJ Dillashaw. Like, look how he was able to defend the takedown heads from Dominic Cruz and really make him pay with his power shots. Like, I think there's guys out there right now who are really difficult matches for TJ in a five-round atmosphere. And I think Aljo is too. Like, I'm picking Sterling in this fight for a reason. But I do think this is going to be a very close fight. And I could really see it coming down to, okay, we're tied 2-2 going into the fifth. Who's going to win this final round? Both guys have great cardio and have great lasting ability in their fights. But I am ever so slightly going to pick Sterling.
Let us know down below in the comments section who you have in this matchup. Will it be the Funkmaster Aljamain Sterling? Will it be the California man TJ Dillashaw? A big time main event coming up at lightweight. Charles Oliveira taking on Islam Makhachev. It should be a great fight. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Charles Oliveira's got the belt in my graphic, and coming up this weekend in the main event of UFC 280, he's still my champion, Charles Oliveira, do Bronx, taking on Islam Makhachev. And if it wasn't for Adriano Martins, if he was just like erased off the record, it would be an undefeated streak at 22-0 for Makhachev. Now, he did get cold cocked in that one fight against Martins early on in his UFC tenure, but it's been wins and roses ever since. And for Makhachev, his last time out, a short notice replacement in Bobby Green due to multiple leg injuries to Benil Dariush. He takes on Green, he takes him down, he finishes him very quickly in a fight that was to be expected. And for Makhachev, the commentary around that fight was that they were going to rematch him or try and put the fight back together with Dariush. But listen, waiting worked out for him, and he gets to take on Oliveira. And for Oliveira, his last time out, I mean, he looked very, very good against Justin Gaethje. Obviously, the commentary is around the weight, and should he actually have that belt around his arm in our picture? I don't know. Remains to be seen. Again, for Makhachev, being on such short notice, his last fight was a catchweight of 160 pounds. But I do have a quote from UFC Vice President of Regulatory Affairs, UFC Hall of Famer Mark Ratner, on MMA on SiriusXM. And after the Oliveira weigh-in debacle, he said, "I can say for sure that Friday there was nothing wrong with the official scale. Maybe there was an issue with the practice scale, but either way, Oliveira did miss the mark at 155 his last time out against Gaethje, but it doesn't take away from the performance that he ended up having."
I was going to say, he still dropped Justin Gaethje and choked him unconscious, which is like insane. Like, that's the thing about Charles Oliveira. If you want me to make a basketball comparison with Charles Oliveira, it's very obvious. It's Giannis Antetokounmpo. You go from a guy who you never expected anything from, and now you expect him to only win and nothing else. And it really has been wild for Oliveira, because everybody remembers him, oh, he was this great submission artist, and wow, you've got to watch out if you fight him on the mat. But every single fight, we started seeing these improvements in his striking. And it all seemed to culminate in that matchup against Jared Gordon, which, let's be honest, that was fucked up to begin with. Like, he never should have fought Jared Gordon.
Is it as fucked up as Charles Oliveira walking a lion and then his coach going, whoa, at one point because he got a little bit too close?
I would never do. Like, I'm so scared of lions and stuff like that. But, like, if it ever turned around and gave me a mean look, it's over. Charles Oliveira looked pretty confident walking that lion. So maybe you can look into it a little bit. But for Oliveira, that's the one thing I want to say about this fight. He's so much better than Islam Makhachev striking. It's not even close. And Islam's not this, like, terrible striker. He's basic, don't get me wrong. He's not going to do anything that really wows you in a Yair Rodriguez way. But the improvements that Oliveira have been able to make throughout his career overshadow anything Makhachev's also been able to do throughout his career. And that's the weird thing about this fight. I think Oliveira's way better on the feet, even though we all know him for his jiu-jitsu, of course. And Makhachev isn't terrible on the feet, even though we all know him for his wrestling. But I think you got to go back and look at the Makhachev fights against Armin Tsarukyan and Davi Hamosh. I think those are the two most important fights to go back and watch, because Tsarukyan was one of the few guys who's ever been able to grapple with Islam Makhachev. And after the fight, you're like, oh, okay. Like, it wasn't this, like, life-threatening thing. Like, you can do it if you're really good. And Davi Hamosh kind of hurt Islam Makhachev a couple times in the feet. That's all I'm going to say. I saw another guy say this on Twitter, and a bunch of people with names I don't understand immediately attacked him, so we'll just leave it at that. But Davi Hamosh was landing some really nice jabs on the outside to Islam Makhachev that was really making it tough for him to go in there and close the distance afterwards. And those are the types of skills that make me think, okay, Charles Oliveira can definitely replicate some of that game plan. But the conversation that I've always had around this fight is that Makhachev does have one huge advantage over Charles Oliveira. It's physical strength. And I really do think that's the important part, because when you look at the type of submissions that Makhachev goes for, they're not necessarily the Damian Maia kind, where it's okay, I get you down, then I do a bunch of these tricks basically to get your back, then I submit you. Makhachev's going to grab your arm, your one arm, with both of his, and then basically just overpower you in a lot of these positions. And I know it's wild to say, but this is the case. Charles Oliveira isn't unsubmittable. I know he gets a lot of submission victories himself.
It's kind of like Nikita Krylov.
Don't ever mention Nikita Krylov. Charles Oliveira is so much better than Krylov grappling, but you are right. They're two guys who have a lot of wins with their grappling, but they have some losses too. The difference is Oliveira, I favor against pretty much everybody with his grappling, and it's just this weird X factor of the strength of Makhachev that I could see giving Oliveira problems.
And Matt, bring up a Davi Hamosh fight in which the judges' final tally, 29-27, 30-26, 30-26, but I do agree with you. If you go back and you watch that fight, there are certain things that can carry over into a matchup like this against Charles Oliveira. You can't be so, you know, just stubborn about it. But if you do look at Oliveira, we know this, it's noted. But of the all-time UFC ranks, 9 all-time in fights in the UFC at 30.
Kind of wild.
5th all-time in wins at 21. Number 1 all-time in finishes at 19. Number 1 all-time in submissions at 16. And tied for first with Cowboy Cerrone with 18 bonuses. And it's absolutely wild.
He's made $900,000 just for being that much better at his job.
You look at it for Oliveira, a win over Michael Chandler, he gets the belt. A win over Dustin Poirier, also for the belt. A win over Justin Gaethje for fun. For fun. No belt in that one. For Islam Makhachev, you do look at it, the 5-on-in. Davi Hamosh about 3 years ago. The layoffs are obviously a big deal. The win over Drew Dober, he smoked him. He smoked him like a nice turkey at Thanksgiving. He beats Thiago Moises by submission. Didn't see that one coming as easy as it did. He beats Dan Hooker very quickly, and then he beat Bobby Green very, very quickly. Matt, this is the part of the video where we throw it on over to the fans in our YouTube community tab. Threw it out there earlier on today.
Interesting.
71% of you have Charles Oliveira to get the win. I don't know who you are.
Henry Tyler's.
Tyler Gordon saying the champ has a name, and it is Charles Oliveira. Tyler's a fan of the channel. Benjamin is saying, I got Charles for the win. Will T's got Charles, and he's that confident. Tommy's saying, heart says Charles, brain says Islam. We'll go down a little bit more. Chad the UFC dad, hate to say it, but I think it's Islam's fight to lose. I love seeing fighters like Charles make a resurrection late in their career, but Islam's wrestling is on another level, and I'm a BJJ guy.
Well said, Chad the UFC dad.
Damon, Islam by KO, TKO, round 1 or 2. Luke LaRoche saying, my money is on Islam, and Darren saying, 72% of the people are wrong. And I said, Darren must have a crystal ball, and he says, yeah.
I was surprised to see that many people pick Charles Oliveira, and I understand. From a fan's perspective, he's the much more entertaining of the two fighters, so that's why people are going to pick him. But still, the fact that the odds at open were so heavily skewed towards Makhachev.
The odds. Makhachev open minus 300, minus 180 for Charles Oliveira, open plus 250, plus 150 right now. And Matt, I will say this. The last time we saw a champion, the incumbent, come in as an underdog, Glover Teixeira lost to Jiří Procházka. That was the last one.
Made it damn close, though, didn't he? That's the weird thing about this fight. Again, both guys could have success in the other one's specialty. Oliveira can have success on the mat just like Makhachev can because they're both that good at their grappling. Like, Makhachev's barely going to struggle wrestling with anybody in this division, and Oliveira's barely going to struggle with jiu-jitsu with everybody in the division, except for when they meet each other, and that's why I think this fight is going to be so incredible. I'd be very curious to see if the fight does go late into the third, fourth, and fifth round, who that does favor, because if Makhachev's getting a lot of offensive takedowns, not really having to work for a lot of them, then maybe those last couple of rounds are going to be very beneficial because Oliveira is the one who's had to work out of tough positions. But on the flip side, Oliveira has been getting ready for 5-round fights for what feels like about 3 years now, and he's only fought the best of the best. Like, he's fought Michael Chandler, Dustin Poirier, and Justin Gaethje.
Ooh.
Three of the most dangerous men on, like, the face of the earth, no matter what combat sport or weight division you're in. Islam Makhachev beat Bobby Green and Dan Hooker. Now, to be fair, the skills that he was able to demonstrate in those matchups definitely tells us that he deserves this one, but I do think there has to be something to be said for Oliveira being in these tough fights, knowing how to get through a tough fight and knowing how to win a tough fight.
And we've seen Charles Oliveira in these fights and in compromising positions and taken down in some of these fights. If you look at it against the Carney Nick Lentz, I mean, gee whiz. I'm trying to compare. I'm grasping at straws at this point, but trying to make a couple of comparisons. But if you go down through it, I mean, yeah, he had that tough break between 2015 and 2017. It's been all roses for Oliveira recently.
Nick Lentz must have looked at Charles Oliveira like that meme where LeBron was playing for Miami and Kawhi checked in with the Spurs where he's like, like, why did the UFC feel the need to make Charles Oliveira beat Nick Lentz 7 times?
It's just the way that it was. But if you're making an official prediction here, what's the pick?
I would love to be able to sit here and say Charles Oliveira is going to be a champion for a really long time because I really do enjoy watching his fighting style. Like, I don't like or dislike any fighters in the UFC. I don't watch a lot of interviews and stuff. I just care about how their skills are demonstrated in the cage. But, like, I like watching Charles Oliveira fight. I don't think that's a hot take. Anybody who likes MMA likes watching him fight. So I guess I'll say for Oliveira what I say for Jiří Procházka anytime my friends ask me if he's going to be champion for a long time. You can't be that exciting and that good. Those two colors just don't rhyme. And for Oliveira, I think his level of excitement is going to help him in some of the exchanges. He might even drop Makhachev and look really good earlier. But I think that even if Islam does get dropped, he'll be able to panic wrestle his way into a good position. And I really do keep on coming back to the fact that Makhachev has been able to get out wrestled in some spots for like 2 seconds, and then he normally ends up on top. With jiu-jitsu, it'll be interesting to see if Oliveira can clamp onto a tight submission and maybe go for a sweep or anything off that. But I still find myself picking Makhachev, even though I'm glad you brought up the initial odds, because listen, there's some fights, there's a lot of fights every weekend where the odds come out, I don't check them when they first come out, and then by the time we get to the fight, the odds will be very different, and then you'll bring it up. This fight, I knew, like, well in advance that Islam was a minus 300 favorite when the odds had first come out. It felt like that was a big talking point, and it's really nice to see that the average bettor and the average fan does seem to think that Charles Oliveira has a much better chance than a 3-1 underdog.
Yeah, I mean, a large amount of the fans have Oliveira to win, and the odds are closing in closer to par, which, again, favors the champion, but when you do look at a matchup like this, Poirier, great boxer, good jiu-jitsu, good wrestling. Is he leaps and bounds over Oliveira in any one aspect? Like, leaps and leaps and leaps. His boxing, for sure. But is he, like, on that, like, S-tier of boxing? Is Dustin Poirier?
Yeah.
It's pretty darn good. Islam Makhachev, to me, seems to be, like, S-tier, and then he broke that ceiling, and then he's
in boxing?
Sorry, with his wrestling. Islam, to me, has that skill set. So for me, I like Islam Makhachev with that, and I think Makhachev is going to have a lot of success there. Now, again, we've seen fighters, Martins, Hamoshin, Bits, Zarukian, have different successes against Makhachev. Makhachev's human. He can be beaten. They can build a robot that could probably win. But if you look at Islam Makhachev, I think it's his fight to lose at this point. I think Oliveira has all of the skills. He's much more well-rounded. We know this. But really eager to see what we get out of the comments this week on this one. Because, of course, 72% of you here on the channel right now going with the champion to defend. Both of us going with the man who is challenging. And I'm going to say challenging. I'm going to say Islam Makhachev. But, Matt, we have a big-time week scheduled for this week. Sidekick coming out on Saturday where we hang out, and as DC would say, we chop it up.
We chop it up.
Fans,
listen, you guys have hung with us for the past month getting over these mediocre fight night cards. This is finally one of the big ones. We have made it. You know how, like, you'll be in the desert, there's like a mirage,
you don't
know if it's water or not. This is the thing that you think you see. This is an incredible card from top to bottom. It is an incredibly stacked one. There's a really high level of depth to it. Great fights all through the prelims and the main card. Like I said earlier on, this main card is basically 5 title fights or title eliminators, and I think that's something we can all agree with and really get down with.
2 hours before the prelims, question mark kicks here on the channel. We went 9-2 last week on the card that was Grasso versus Araújo. So you're going to want to make sure you tune in for that. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.